Chair McGrath, the floor is yours.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the virtual board meeting of the California Regional Water Quality Control Board, San Francisco Bay Region. I have to be a little bit sad here. We had projected to be back in person, and I do miss human contact. But unfortunately, the Delta variant is making life more difficult than we thought. I'm Jim McGrath. I'm chair of the San Francisco Bay Regional Water Quality Control Board, and we'll call the roll for other board members in just 1 minute. But first, I want to note that today's board meeting is conducted in accordance with the COVID-19 emergency order to comply with public gathering limitations. As authorized by the governor's executive orders, there's no physical meeting. For people who only want to listen or watch the meeting, the board's customary webcast is also available. In addition, we are receiving public comment through a Zoom meeting platform. If you intend to comment or think you might be interested in commenting, you should already be in the Zoom meeting room. If you've not already received a link, you can visit our website and sign up. And here comes the cool part. Guy, share the website address. See, I couldn't do that without electronics. For those in the Zoom meeting, you will be on mute and your camera turned off until it is your turn to speak. Our board clerk, Guy, will then unmute you. When you are done speaking and the board members have completed asking questions, you will again be placed on mute. For all speakers, we ask that you state your name when you are called upon. We appreciate your patience and understanding during this extraordinary time, which has lasted and lasted and lasted. We will now call the roll. Guy?
Member Young?
Here.
Board Member Gunther?
Here.
Board Member Hacker? Board Member Hacker? I just didn't hear. Sorry.
Hear me now?
Oh, perfect. Thank you. Yep. Okay. Board Member Kissinger?
Here.
Vice Chair Batty?
Here.
And Chair McGrath?
Here. Thank you. Michael Montgomery, the executive officer, has informed me that we have new staff members to introduce. Mike, take it away.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, Board. We're really excited to be introducing a lot of new staff. Some as a result of some new positions, and then some a surge in backfilling positions. I want to extend a special thanks to our Management Services Division for doing a great job of working with Sacramento to allow us to onboard so many staff in such a short period of time. We have six folks to introduce. We'll start in our Watersheds program with Maggie Monahan. Maggie?
Good morning. My name is Maggie Monahan. I'm one of the section leads in the Watershed Management Division. And today I'm excited to introduce Rashid Kava, a new water resource control engineer who joined us on September 1st. Rashid has a background in both consulting and academia. He began his career as an environmental engineer at a consulting firm in Iran, where he worked on waste management and wastewater treatment projects. After 5 years, he decided to pursue a PhD and came to the US to study at Temple University in Philadelphia. His research was on the biodegradation of emerging contaminants in soil and water. After completing his PhD in 2015, he stayed in academia and taught environmental engineering courses at several universities, including Penn State University, my alma mater, Bucknell University, and California State University in Sacramento. Like me, Rashid felt the lure of California, the idea of being able to work on environmental challenges like water scarcity and climate change in a state with some of the most progressive environmental policies, brought him here and ultimately to us. Rashid will be working in the waste discharge to land and recycled water programs. Outside of work, Rashid enjoys listening to audiobooks, spending time in nature, and hanging out with friends and family. Please join me in welcoming Rashid.
Thanks, Maggie, for introducing me. Hello, everybody. I'm really happy to be with you. And, you know, it's a great pleasure to join the team and working with you, all of you. Thanks.
Welcome.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome aboard. I have to say, Maggie and Mike and Rashid, it's really exciting to have somebody with expertise in what happens with the soil, because the natural breakdown and whether or not it's sufficient is a really important issue. I mean, we don't want to hammer people if we've got soil that will do it, but we don't want to under-regulate either. So good choice. Good level of expertise. Welcome aboard.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Rashid. Next up, we have from our Groundwater Protection Division, Nathan King.
Good morning, Chair and board members. My name is Nathan King. I'm a senior engineering geologist in the Groundwater Protection Division. Please welcome Solmaz Marzugi to the Water Board. Solmaz has joined the Department of Defense section of the Groundwater Protection and Waste Containment Division as a water resource control engineer. She has a bachelor's in chemical engineering and has received a master's and PhD in civil and environmental engineering. Solmaz's PhD research involved risk assessment of oil spill to aquatic life. She developed a mechanistic model called phototoxic target lipid model that predicts UV-enhanced toxicity of petroleum chemicals, such as PAHs, to aquatic organisms when they are exposed to solar radiation. Her MS research focused on designing a hydrophobic membrane-based biosolids treatment and water reclamation system, for which she performed experimental and modeling efforts. Solmaz had worked in private sector as a water wastewater engineer and environmental consultant before joining the State Water Board in 2018. Solmaz is passionate about protecting the environment and public health. To boost her morale, she enjoys spending time with her family, paddleboarding, hiking, and yoga. Please welcome Solmaz. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair and board members. Thank you so much, Nathan, for the introduction. I'm excited about joining Region 2, and it's been a great experience so far for me. And I cannot wait to meet each one of you in person, hopefully anytime soon. Thank you.
Welcome aboard.
Thank you so much.
Another impressive background.
Yeah. Next up, we have Elizabeth Wells in the Toxics Division to introduce a couple of different new staff.
Good morning, Chair McGrath and members of the board. I'm Elizabeth Wells. I'm a senior water resource control engineer in the Toxic Cleanups Division. I'm thrilled to be here today, coming from beautiful Boulder, Colorado, to introduce three new members of our team to you. So first up, we have Helen Hild. So hopefully Helen can turn her camera on. So Helen has joined us as an engineering geologist in early August. She grew up in New England, which explains why she's an avid Boston sports fan. But she left New England to head to Tulane University in New Orleans, where she got her bachelor's degree in geology. After graduation, she headed west to work, and she chose California because she appreciated the policy and regulations our state has in place to protect the environment. Following 6 years of work as an environmental consultant, she decided to check out the other side and joined us here at the Water Board. She'll be overseeing a variety of cleanup projects, including shoreline PCB sites. And we are very excited to have Helen join us.
Thanks, Wiz. Yeah, happy to be here and excited to get started.
All right.
Welcome to the other side.
Thank you.
All right. Second up is Rachel Lim. Rachel has joined us as an engineering geologist last week. So she grew up in Singapore, Toronto, and the San Francisco Bay Area, and she loves Northern California, and the redwoods and the beach drew her to the University of California at Santa Cruz. Rachel got her bachelor's degree in earth science and then returned to the Bay Area for work. After 3 years doing geotechnical work, she pivoted to environmental consulting to do work that she felt more closely matched her interests. So after 2 years assisting responsible parties, Rachel decided to check out the other side and joined us here at the Water Board. She will be overseeing a variety of cleanup sites, including former dry cleaners. And we're delighted to have Rachel join us.
Welcome.
Hi. Hi. I'm really excited to join such a great team and to continue a career in environmental field.
All right. Thanks, Rachel.
Thank
All
you.
Right. And last but not least, third, we have Nicole Ulikovic. So Nicole will join us. And Nicole joined us as a scientific aide yesterday. She grew up in Texas, and in the 10th grade, she figured out that she wanted to study civil engineering as a career. So Nicole moved west to attend UC Berkeley, where she saw a campus full of a wide range of interests, experiences, and opportunities. And during her junior year at Cal, it was her fluid mechanics class that sparked her interest in and directed her specifically toward the environmental side of civil engineering. So this past May, Nicole graduated with a bachelor's degree in civil engineering, and she will be supporting our cleanup efforts in the toxic cleanup division, and we're thrilled to have her as part of our team.
Hi, I'm really thrilled to be here and to be working on projects that matter with people who care.
Awesome.
Welcome.
Welcome, Nicole.
Welcome. Thanks, right, Nicole.
Thanks, Wiz.
Uh-huh. we've got in batting cleanup here, Bill Johnson, to introduce a new staff person. Bill?
Everybody knows
Bill. I don't have to introduce him.
Well, it's like every division's getting new staff. It's like you get new staff and you get new staff and you get new staff. So I got new staff too. I want to welcome Carrie O'Connor. There she is. She's a new water resource control engineer. She's going to be working in Robert Schlipp's NPDES permitting section. Carrie's going to be working on permits for municipal wastewater treatment plants, primarily in the North Bay. This past May, she graduated with a bachelor's degree in civil engineering from UC Berkeley. While she was studying for that degree, she was working for us as a scientific aide in the NPDES division, helping out with our pretreatment work and our collection system audits. And she actually helped with one of the EO report items for last month about sanitary sewer overflows and wipes. So she's been doing a great job, and we're so happy that we get to keep her on as a full-time engineer. So she can continue her career here at the Water Board. For fun, she enjoys hiking and camping, and eventually I'm sure she'll earn enough vacation time that we'll let her do some of those things again someday. Thanks. Welcome, Carrie.
Thank you, Bill, for the introduction. I am very excited to continue to be working here at the Water Board, and especially excited to be continuing to work in the NPDES division. So thank you.
Welcome, Carrie.
Thank you.
Welcome, Carrie. Welcome, Carrie. Thanks, Bill.
Mike, that's an amazing advance, and thanks to you and your management team for bringing aboard such a wonderful new crop of regional board staff. I just think it's exciting and invigorating to see this building for the future, and I really am taken by Nicole's phrase of working on projects that matter with people who care. That could almost be our slogan.
Thank you so much. Yeah, really hats off to all the hiring managers. It is, we are a bureaucracy, and there is a fair amount of work in the hiring process, and they work very well with our management services division, and Kimmy and Anna do an amazing job working with Sacramento to bring these new staff on, as well as our IT support folks who get them computers and, you know, get them set up so that they can participate virtually and in the work that we do. It's been, we're getting surprisingly used to working this way and increasingly efficient. And so many of our new staff are just seamlessly, you know, coming into the organization and working with all of us so well. So thank you, Alexis. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. That brings us to item number two on the agenda, the recognition events for contact tracers. So back to you, Mike.
Yeah, thank you. So I appreciate the board taking some time today. You will all remember that, early in 2020, we were called upon by state government, by CDPH and the governor's office to contribute staff to an effort to support the state's response and particularly individual counties' response to the COVID-19 pandemic. And we asked, the executive team asked divisions to solicit volunteers from their employees, and each division provided a volunteer. We had five folks that served. They were originally only expected to serve for 6 months. They ended up serving for up to a year, when I met with them to talk about their work after they returned, I was, you know, frankly amazed at how readily they adapted to such a different skill set. I mean, really, they all became overnight kind of caseworkers, social workers, and information management specialists. And I thought it would be a great opportunity for the board to hear a little bit from them about their experience. We have five. We want to recognize one contact tracer, Rusty Paleo. He since has left the water board. Katrina Kaiser is on leave. We have three here today to talk about their experience. Will Burrell, Devender Narala, and Rebecca Nordenholt. And I'm going to ask them each to share a little bit about their experience, because I think it's very interesting for us to hear about. It's very important for us to hear about what it was like for these staff to work on the inside of the pandemic and to play, really, frankly, such a heroic role in the last year and a half as the state has responded to this crisis. So I'm going to start by calling up Rachel Nordenholt. Rachel, are you? Can you bring your screen up?
Rebecca.
Rebecca, I'm sorry, Rebecca.
That's okay. Thanks, Mike. Good morning, Chair McGrath and members of the board. My name's Rebecca Nordenholt, and I'm an environmental scientist in the planning division. But from July 2020 to June 2021, I was redirected to work as a contact tracer. So before being assigned to a specific health department, all of the redirected staff attended a three-day training where we learned about COVID-19 and contact tracing. And then after that statewide training, we were assigned to a public health department based on need across the state. And I was assigned to the Los Angeles County Department of Public Health. So when I started, I learned that in addition to contact tracing, which is calling people that were exposed to COVID-19, we'd also be doing case interviews, meaning we'd have to call people that actually tested positive for COVID-19 and gather information about their close contacts and their symptoms. So after all this training, I was actually reassigned to work as a team lead instead of an interviewer. So I didn't make the calls myself. I actually ended up leading a team of six redirected staff from agencies across the state. And in that role, I distributed and balanced the workload amongst my team to ensure all of our cases were getting called in a timely manner. I reviewed call reports for completeness and forwarded cases to special teams for follow-up when needed. And I also communicated procedural changes to our team. So our workflow and procedures would change often, sometimes daily, sometimes more than once a day, to reflect new public health guidelines and accommodate the ever-changing caseload. But more than anything, it was just my job to support my team members and help them navigate some really difficult situations on their calls. So in addition to answering their questions and providing resources, I did a lot of virtual team building activities to build camaraderie and prevent burnout. And the people at the California Department of Public Health would always say creating this contact tracing program was like building a plane while trying to fly it. And it got kind of old hearing that, but it's definitely an accurate way to describe it. After a crash course in contact tracing, we were sort of thrown into this new role during the height of the summer surge last year. And it seemed like once we finally had our bearings, things kind of started to calm down. And then we were all just biding our time and holding our breath, waiting for things to get worse. And come fall, sure enough, cases started creeping up again. And by December, LA County was consistently reporting over 10,000 new cases per day. It's hard to really explain what that experience was like, but I'm just so proud and humbled by my team. They remained dedicated to this overwhelming role that is, you know, not the career path they chose. And some of them did not even volunteer to be there. They were voluntold, but they all just did such an amazing job. And it was really great to be a part of. So after we made it out of the winter surge and vaccines were available, we also started conducting outreach where we'd call people to educate them about vaccines and help them make appointments. So that's a little background on what my experience was like. And despite all of the challenges, I'm very thankful to have the opportunity to have been part of this program and help California in this way. And now I'll pass it back to Mike or on to Will.
Board members, do you have any questions for Rebecca? It's an interesting story.
Yeah. I take it you did all of this remotely. Is that right?
Yes.
I can't imagine building a team when you guys are all remotely operating. It's amazing.
Yeah,
it was weird, especially not everyone had web cameras. So in some instances, we couldn't even see each other.
Wow.
But it worked.
Thank you, Rebecca. Will, you want to share some thoughts?
Sure. Thank you, Rebecca. Like Rebecca, I was assigned to LA County as a contact tracer at first. And then very quickly, they're like, well, everyone has to do case management calls as well. And so we went through a week of training for State Department of Health. And then we got to LA County and we found out that LA County had their own internal systems that they were using that was different from the state. So we went through an additional week of training with LA County's systems and how they wanted their script was different and how they wanted things recorded was different. So it's kind of to reemphasize what Rebecca said, that like building a ship while it's flying was a thing that they said often, and it did in fact feel like that. Things got updated pretty regularly, and one of the things that helped out the most actually was during the winter surge, they finally were allowing people to send text messages before calls, or actually the system would automatically send a text message. And then we could flag people for further text follow-up. But that really helped in getting people to know that we would be calling and to answer the phone. So it was a little bit less of a cold call because during the summer, there was a lot of, why are you calling me? Where are you from? How did you get my information? As the pandemic went on and as more people started to understand the seriousness of COVID-19 and how transmissible it was, there just became a lot more understanding from people that when we did call of what we were trying to do, and just finding that a lot of people had questions about the virus, how long it'll last, simple things like, should I keep my children here who aren't sick, or should I, let them go stay with family? The answer to that would always be, obviously your children have been exposed, so you need to keep them from going to other households. But, when will my symptoms abate? Some of the hardest questions we got were revolving around people who either didn't have insurance, or people who had to take time off work and really couldn't afford to do so. And so LA County had some resources for people who needed food or people who needed like special in-home care or things like that on their website that we could point people to. I found myself talking to people quite a bit actually about the program where the government made funds available for people to take up to 10 days off work due to COVID-19, and just sending them that information from just Department of Labor, making sure that they talk to their HR people about that. There's just a lot of fear about, especially from people who had been tested positive, like, what is going to happen? Am I going to die? When can I go back to work? And so more than just information gathering, a lot of it did become just like trying to walk people through or what to expect. And there was great teams. I wasn't on Rebecca's team, but I did work very closely with my team lead, and she was always available and always able to give me support if I had questions. There were a few times when I had calls with pregnant mothers, and those were especially anxious calls. And so there's teams for pregnant mothers with the Department of Public Health. So I would refer her to a follow-up team through my team lead. And then that specialized team would call her. Same for people experiencing homelessness or people who had had deaths in their family. There were special teams that I could refer people to contact. That was my 9 months experience from June until March of this past year.
Thank you, Will.
Well, that's an amazing and sobering story. Thank you.
Thanks. Unlike Will and Rebecca, Devender was assigned to a really rural county, Kings County. So he had a very also sort of a different experience because of the demographics of the community he served. Devender, you want to share some thoughts?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Mike. My name is Devender Narala. I'm a water resource control engineer in the watershed division. Being assigned like others early in July, been on the assignment for 1 year. Good morning, board chair and members of the board. And actually, it was a very humbling experience for me. We started off as a contact tracers. Just 30 seconds on that is, you know, you call people who were exposed or possibly exposed to the COVID-19 and tell them what to do, what not to do. And then I became a case investigator where I'm calling people who tested positive and give them instructions on help them with many things. As Mike was talking about, I was with Kings County, predominantly quite a few of them were Spanish-speaking individuals. So we had this wonderful feature on our database called a soft phone. And I wish we can also put this in if this long distance continues to our office too. You're on your computer. You just dial the number, just like you know, and on your headphones, and you can talk to anybody. And when somebody calls you, you can receive when you're working at your workstation. So there's no need for a regular phone or anything else, and it's just voice over IP. So that technology worked very well. And we had the Spanish interpreters on where we can bring them on. One of the interesting things is they were very helpful, the Spanish interpreters, and the Spanish-speaking people were very, very cooperative. And the Spanish interpreter talks to them and says, if they go on for 30, 40 seconds, and I say, can you translate? Everything is okay. I said, wow, the 30, 40 seconds of answer was, it's okay. So it was kind of interesting not knowing the language, but trying to communicate with them. Again, as I said, it was very, very well. But again, at the same time, some of the things Mike was talking about is we became social workers overnight. And when we had to make calls to parents that their kids were tested positive, that was really hard. Calling in a case where the individual was in the hospital, you can hear in the background the air pumping machine going whoosh, whoosh. And still they were taking the phone calls and said, yeah, I'm in the hospital struggling for my life. It was, you know, very hard to take that when you're talking to them and trying to, you know, help. And I had made quite a few phone calls where the grandparents and parents were not able to pay their utility bills, pay their rent. They don't have food. And luckily, we had so much resources available, and we were able to help them and tell them that. And they used to thank us, you know, profusely saying, thank you very much. You know, thanks for helping. And that felt good. And there were cases where they said, who are you? Why are you calling me? How did you get hold of my number? And click, hang up on us saying that, you know, this is a prank call or whatever it is. And we had to deal with those kind of, you know, all the way from this side to this side. So it was a very, very humbling experience. The only thing that I found out during the last 1 year was the change was the only constant, like the Will and Rebecca was talking about. Things were constantly changing every week. I got trained as a case investigator, contact tracer, then schools liaison, then whoever got vaccinated, how to do this. But quite a few times we did not even do some of the assignments, but we were trained a lot, and I was very thankful for all the training. And as I said, you know, the most difficult part was telling somebody that they are tested positive or they lost a very individual in their family and trying to cope with that. And we didn't, I mean, sometimes I had no how to express my, you know, listen, these people are not related to me. But in the end, I felt like I had 1 year of very good experience, and I felt like I helped the community. And I'd like to actually thank the water board and the management at the regional board for giving me the time off or in a way to assignment to go do this thing. I learned personally a lot. And again, thank you for the board also. Appreciate it. Back to you, Mike.
Yeah, thank you, Devender. So, I just want to take a minute to thank you all, Rebecca, Will, Devender, for taking some time to talk with us today. Your adaptability, your sacrifice, really just emblematic of, you know, what the best at Water Board employees bring to the work environment. So again, I just want to take a moment to thank you, and especially for taking this opportunity to share with the board your experiences and just the reminder of the disproportionate impact on disadvantaged communities that this pandemic has had, and the subpopulations that were intensely affected that I don't think we always think about. So thank you for that reminder. And I'll hand it over to the board for any questions. Jim.
I'll jump in. So first of all, thank you all. I mean, it's humbling and it's inspiring to hear your stories. And, thank you for taking this on. I got a call from a contract tracer last year, and it is a disconcerting call that you get. So I can only imagine what you're up against. I guess I just want to, I have a quick question that I would throw out to you that any or all of you could answer is, if you were going to share with us anything that, how this has informed how you will view your work going forward, or how this might shift priorities or influence your career and your work going forward. Is there any ahas that you would share with us?
Let me go ahead. I mean, one thing I feel like I can share is the humbling experience I've said is, I always talk to a lot of dischargers and felt like, okay, this is the rules, these are the regulations, this is what you should do. Now I feel like, what kind of a situation they must be in. They're not able to pay their rent. They're not paying. I have more empathy towards these people, and I'm going to be more conscious saying that what kind of a situation they are in there for being in the situation that they could not submit a report or could not do something. I want to give them a little bit more benefit of doubt, and that's what I'm going to bring it here and say, you know what? There is something that's going on in their life that I want to listen to. Thank you.
Thank you.
I would like to also share a little bit from my experience. This is Will, sorry. I know that this experience has made me just much more aware of the social justice aspect of the pandemic and how disproportionately affected low income and a lot of Hispanic families were, because they were the people still going to work. And so having gone through this experience, I am now like involving myself with the racial equity meetings that are happening with the Water Board and with the environmental justice initiatives we're having. And just the experience has just made me more aware of, I guess, my own privilege of being able to work from home and being able to keep myself and my family safe, just how disproportionately structured our society is in that way.
Thank you,
Rebecca. Yeah, I would just echo that. I think the empathy and the way that we sort of think about and approach our communities that we're serving is just completely changed in a like in a positive way. I think we're going to be just more empathetic and but then more effective regulators, because as we learned with contact tracing, it's like using the stick doesn't always work. You have to meet people where they are so that they can comply because they want to. They just don't always have the resources to do it.
Thank you all.
Yeah, thank you.
Any other board members?
Well, I'll just echo Jane's comments by saying it was a big sacrifice for you guys to put your regular professional lives on hold for the year. And you really did the board proud by doing what you guys did. So thank you very much.
I want to thank you all. And I really appreciate the insight that you've all brought to your service and what it's meant to you to listen more. I guess that's an unexpected blessing. We were kind of sore to lose workers for needed work, but I have to reflect with the mistrust in so many communities of the government. What you were doing was service on behalf of what government can do for you. I was really struck by your comments about bringing resources to bear on people who had no way to afford being able to leave. Food resources and the like. So the breadth of service that you have is really remarkable and humbling to me. And I want to thank Mike for bringing this to us. It's very nice to hear. Very difficult to hear too.
One thought, I feel that what Devender, Will, and Rebecca have shared is an example of perhaps some future conversation we might all have about career development opportunities for Board 2 by allowing staff to maybe be shared with a county health department for maybe a couple of months or maybe even part-time for a few months, so that those receiving agencies would understand what authorities and strengths and mission the Water Board plays in the Bay Area, and that people in Board 2 would have the opportunity of working closer with the public we serve as these have done. And I just think it's an enriching experience. It's not unlike the Intergovernmental Personnel Act that we know well from the federal government, but I just see it's not easy to do from, you know, certain personnel rules and liability point of view, but I just see the opportunity for some career development discussions in the future when we can.
Thank you, Alexis. All right, well, thank you again, Devender, Will, Rebecca. I really appreciate the time you took today, and the stories you shared were really impactful. So thanks again for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks again. With that, we'll move on to the public forum. Guy, are there any speakers in the waiting room?
There are not.
With that, we'll go on to minutes. Michael, you have no suggested edits. If there are any from the board, I'd like a motion to approve the minutes.
So moved.
Moved by Dr. Second. Guy, can we do this with a hand vote? I think we can.
Hand vote's good.
All in favor, raise your hands.
I'm going to abstain just because I wasn't at the meeting.
That motion carries. That brings us to item 5, the Chair, Board Member, and Executive Officer reports. We'll start with Andy Gunther. Dr. Gunther.
Thank you, Jim. I just wanted to... briefly call my fellow board members' attention to two recent articles. One was an article in the Chronicle by John King that went under the headline, San Francisco Bay Tides Are Going to Rise, Should We Dam the Golden Gate First? I think that the answer to this question is no. I think the concept of placing a dam at the Golden Gate is both very short-sighted and counterproductive, and I will be explaining my position in conjunction with my colleague at SFEI, Jeremy Lowe, in writing. Then I should be able to distribute this to the board members next week. If you didn't see Mr. King's article, it includes a statement by the mayor of San Jose indicating that he thinks this is certainly a proposal we should investigate. And while I certainly don't have any, I don't feel like we can always include this as an option, I think it's not really going to pan out to be something that is worth our time. In addition, I wanted to draw people's attention to an article in the New York Times today or yesterday about a program in the Netherlands called Room for the River. And it is a reflection on a Dutch program to reestablish floodplains in their nation and as a way to control flooding. While we're, of course, in the midst of a drought and terrible fires, intense flooding from intense rainstorms during an El Nino year will certainly be in our future. And I was very impressed with the fact that for the most part, the Dutch were able to avoid loss of life and damage to property during the major downpours that occurred in Europe last month because they have provided these catch basins around their nation to accept floodwaters during these extreme events. So that's everything that I have to report at the moment.
Andy, it reminds me of the proposal to pipe water from Mississippi. One would think that people who have access to advisors might actually consult with them before they go public with ideas that are so impractical. Board Member Hacker, we'll turn to you.
Nothing for looking back, but looking ahead, in a couple weeks, I'm going to be hosting a panel with current MIT students to try and broaden some ideas about environmental careers of the kind that we offer here.
Thank you, Alexis. Bill Kissinger next.
Nothing from me, Jim. Thank you.
Don Young.
Nothing from me, sir. Thank you.
Jane Batty.
Hi, everybody. I'll just share a couple of things. First of all, it's hard for me not to reflect today on where we were a year ago when we were having our board meeting. Mike and I were just talking about this yesterday, and the fires were engulfing us, and it was the day the sun did not come out. And so I'm sort of looking out at a beautiful blue sky today on the coast and feeling fortunate that we're not in that same spot. But also very aware that, you know, there's fires burning all over the state. So just maybe a little bit of gratitude today for this one day that we're not in that place. I have joined Jim on some recent conversations with Sean McGuire, and I know we're going to hear from him soon. I'll let Jim talk about that. I have also been spending some time with Sustainable Conservation. They are, you know, a nonprofit that is doing a lot of work around water, does some excellent work, and they are really focusing in on drought and groundwater recharge. And I think they're a good group for us to watch and see what they're focusing on. And I think they're contributing to the conversation. And last, I've been working with American Leadership Forum, and I'm on the Silicon Valley Board and the National Board now, and the National Network is over 7,000 senior fellows around the country, and they are wanting to engage more deeply on the climate conversation. And so they may be looking for some expertise from our organization and those that we're collaborating with on the topic. But these are leaders in industry and nonprofits and government around the country. And we need every oar in the water. So I am hoping that more will happen with that. And that's it for me today.
Thank you all. A couple things. Probably the most promising conversation I had was a discussion, of course, by Zoom, with two members of the Watershed Project, Amy Bremer and Juliana Gonzalez. Both are working in Western Contra Costa County, where there are substantial stream resources and recreational resources. And what I've been trying to figure out is how we engage the environmental justice community. There are communities out there that are subject both to shoreline retreat and to fluvial flooding. And how to engage them, how to educate them, how to solicit their opinion and build trust. So they operate through a watershed council. They've been amazingly effective at doing some stream restoration work, which included bicycle trails and walking trails. That's on Wildcat Creek, which still has a steelhead run. And they're very interested in working with us. I also participated with Jane on the conversation with Sean. We'll welcome him aboard. I also had a discussion with Joaquin on July 9th about direction. He's had a series of meetings with individual chairs, that being a little less chaotic and a little more time than a chair's call. We went over our respective work programs, and I think he was supportive of ours. There are some areas such as safe drinking water where the leadership on that is really not so much in our region, but at the State Board in the Central Valley. And then I had a discussion with Felicia Marcus and Barry Nelson, trying to figure out from their perspective what was coming on resilience and what was likely to happen in terms of changes to water supply. As you probably all know, there's litigation joined this morning probably yesterday or some time ago, but reported this morning from San Francisco PUC about whether or not the State Board has the authority to regulate the historic water rights that were issued before they came into effect in 1914. It's very clear that there are winners and losers in a very significant way with ours. Certainly there are things afoot. Certainly it's a complicated issue. And our political system tends to strain mightily to give birth to gnats at times. There will be motion on that. Felicia talked about her own goals, which I think are important and to highlight once. We don't have information on who's using water. And so part of their efforts have been to begin gathering that money. Now, not every person who appropriates water reports what they use, but at least we're starting to develop that. And the Groundwater Act is coming in gradually into effect, and it's being implemented at a local level. Felicia had, I think, two take-home messages. I'll give you the one that's sobering on water supply issues. She did advise that the regional board here should stick to its knitting and look at what it's doing, what its primary goals are, and what it does well. The other thing that she said, which was gratifying, was that she thinks we are the leader, or at least among the leaders in all the regional boards, in looking at climate change and how to adapt to it, and look at institutions, and she encouraged us to keep doing that. So I'll go back to where I started. my efforts have been to try to recognize and gain the trust of those who will be beneficiaries or punished by climate change, and begin the process of engaging them so that we can listen to them, we can hear their ideas, and they can begin to trust us. So I know the players pretty much from San Leandro through the Carquinez, and I'm working with all of them. I'd encourage all of you to do a little bit of that myself. So that completes my report. And it's time to introduce Sean McGuire. I saw you. I made sure you were here. Show us your young face, nice beard, and talk to us.
This is what you get. Thank you, Chair McGrath and members of the board. It's really an honor to be here today as your State Water Resources Control Board member liaison, which is, I think, a wonderful opportunity for us at the State Water Board in our capacity, which is, you know, similar and yet somewhat different from your charge as regional board members, for us to connect and keep each other apprised as to events in both the state level and regional level. And so, you know, I've already actually learned quite a bit this morning, which has been fantastic. I've been on the board for almost 3 years now on the state board. And so it's been quite a whirlwind. You've mentioned already quite a few issues that I'm interested in, be it climate change and drought and our challenges that we're facing with our water management system and our ongoing challenges with environmental justice issues around the state. Certainly there's no shortage of key water-related issues that we're all, I think, interested in and committed to doing our part in addressing the best we can. And I greatly enjoyed your introductions of the new staff this morning. That was fantastic. And I related wholeheartedly with many of the backgrounds, and that, you know, I too came from the other side. You know, I'm an engineer, civil engineer. The first part of my career was spent in consulting, environmental consulting. I worked with a lot of public water agencies, wastewater agencies. I did a lot of large-scale water resources planning work. And so, I mean, it was that type of work that really got me interested in public policy and truly making that difference, and, you know, brought me to the state board initially as staff. I worked in Division of Financial Assistance, dealing with our stormwater grant program. And then I moved over and got an itch, apparently, to figure out this whole water rights system, this convoluted system that Chair McGrath has already discussed a bit this morning, and learned a whole lot there. And then eventually just got the call, you know, and the opportunity and the honor and the responsibility to serve as a state board member. So it's been a whirlwind. It's been a good experience. And I spent the first few years as liaison to the Los Angeles Regional Board, Lahontan Regional Board, and Santa Ana. And as I'm sure you're aware, because I am not Tam Doduck, we've had some changeover in the board recently. And with our newest board member, Nicole Morgan, since Tam stepped down. So we're very happy to have Nicole. She joined us a couple of months ago and has been learning on the fly here. What was the analogy several times shared with the contact tracing team about, you know, building the airplane as it's flying? Well, that's kind of what we're experiencing here in the drought as well, unfortunately. And so I'll share a little bit about that. You know, with changes on the board come opportunities. And so for us, it was an opportunity to kind of re-juggle our liaison roles. And so I just wanted to share with you that I got my first bid. You were it. You know, I have had my eye on the San Francisco Bay Regional Board and just really admire the work that you've done investing in climate change and really being a leader in so many areas. And I've, you know, had an opportunity to talk with Mike Montgomery a couple of times about sea level rise and some other issues, investing in natural infrastructure, levees, things. I've always had an interest in emerging contaminants, and I just know that you're so engaged in all of these topics. I just thought this could be a wonderful information exchange and opportunity for us to leverage, you know, what we're doing at the state level with what, you know, you're leading on as well at the regional level. So I'm just really a privilege to be here today. And then, you know, the other thing is, just so you know, this liaison role is very informal, very fluid, and I'm always open to, you know, talk about any issues that are of interest to you that we're dealing with at the state board that you think you'd like to hear more about. Happy to answer any questions, whether they're items that, you know, I talk about today, whether they're things you think of in between now and the next board meeting or what have you. It's really for you. That's why I'm here. And so, so today, you know, I just wanted to give you an update on a couple items just on the drought and some of our funding opportunities, if that makes sense. And then happy to take the conversation wherever you'd like, or just, you know, chat with you next time. So, so on the drought, I think, you know, we're obviously all aware of, really, frankly, and, you know, this word hopefully is not overused either, but unprecedented conditions that we're facing. I mean, we are in the second driest year in our historical record. Our reservoirs are near lowest capacity ever, and some of them will be here before the end of the year. They're rapidly falling. We've been grappling with impacts from, you know, a failure of all of our forecasting tools to really predict the conditions that we've had this year. There's something on the order of 800,000 acre feet of water, which is a huge amount of water, that were projected to run off from our snowpack and from our rain this spring that simply didn't materialize. You know, whether that water sublimated up into the atmosphere or, you know, it was absorbed by our dry, thirsty soils, or probably some combination of all of that. We are at a point where, regardless, it would have been a dry year, but certainly having to be more reactionary when we realized that that water was not not showing up in our reservoirs meant that there were potentially devastating impacts to our communities, to agriculture in California, to our environment. And all of those, the balancing of that with very limited resources this year has been a huge challenge. You know, we've got there with the support of the administration, as I'm sure you're aware, through a series of executive orders, which have really helped, I think, kind of paved the way for not only this fall and the actions that we've had to take in the recent months, but also the coming year. Because we're being honest and realistic here. You know, we've learned a lot, and we know what we don't know at this point. And what we don't know is how the hydrology will shape up this winter and this spring. And so we're trying to be pragmatic about looking at scenarios and the reality that often droughts are multi-year. They come in bunches. This wouldn't be the first time. It won't be the last. And so, you know, we just need to be ready for any sort of range of scenarios. And, you know, so some of that, you know, the governor's executive orders gave us some authorities that we needed, to set those emergency regulations, which it sounds like SFPUC has some concerns with. And I know a number of others do as well. But nonetheless, you know, our job at the State Water Board, one of our core functions, is drinking water, and then also water management and our managing our water rights system. And we can only do that if we have the authorities and tools to do that. And so part of that in the governor's executive order were giving us the ability to adopt emergency regulations to curtail water right holders in watersheds where water was just simply not available. And in some cases, and I've been up in the watersheds for some of our major rivers, it's a trickle. There is no water, which usually translates to the fact that most of the water then in our, the fresh water that's currently in our rivers flowing into the delta and out to the ocean comes from storage. It's coming from our reservoirs. And as I said, those are at or near low levels, record low levels. And so that's the balancing. Those are the struggles that we've had to deal with. It's the last thing I ever want to do as a board member is to tell folks they can't divert water. You know, whether it's for their farms, whether it's for their communities. We do have some exceptions in there for human health and safety protection. We obviously want folks to have drinking water and no matter what the situation. But we've had to take actions on the Bay Delta. In the Russian River was our first, most recently in the Scott and Shasta River watersheds, and soon at our next board meeting will be Mill and Deer Creeks, which are for environmental flows in the Sacramento River watershed. And so, you know, those have been some of our challenges with the drought. We're hearing a lot about water, small communities, Fort Bragg, others in the San Joaquin Valley that have already experienced or are experiencing potential devastating shortages of water in their communities. And we've been doing everything we can to help get them assistance, whether it's finding an alternative supply source or for some bringing in bottled water or looking at whatever options are on the table for the immediate need and also thinking about long-term options. So, you know, every year we come up with a strategic work plan and we have our goals set out for the year, and you know, dealing with a drought all year and in these circumstances was certainly not in the work plan, but it's been an all hands on deck situation for us for sure. And so we'll continue to work through this, to think through what next year has in store for us. And certainly, you know, you've heard a lot about the contact tracing and obviously the COVID pandemic, which continues. But, you know, this year, one of the, I guess, silver linings, if there is one, is the positive situation with the state budget. And so, you know, we've been fortunate. There's a lot of funding. The governor recognized the needs for investing in the drought response, investing in climate resiliency broadly. And so there's quite a lot of funding being provided to different agencies, to the Resources Agency, the Department of Water Resources, Department of Food and Agriculture, and others for different investments. I just wanted to highlight for you briefly what how much that funding is coming to the State Water Board. And that is approximately $1.4 billion for water and wastewater infrastructure investment. And it's about a 50-50 split. So that's very exciting. It's the water side is really prioritized for disadvantaged community investments. So, you know, it's nice to have an unexpected gift of $700 million that we can invest in communities. We just came out with a drinking water needs assessment earlier this year for small communities and found that there's a several billion-dollar gap over the next 5 years in terms of funding needed to make sure our 7,000 public water systems in the state maintain their solvency and safe drinking water for Californians. So there's a lot of work to do. $700 million sounds like a lot of money, and it is a lot of money. But obviously the needs are high as well. And then the other half of the funding is for wastewater infrastructure investment. We're working on figuring out exactly how that's going to be allocated on both sides. But there's a priority there for septic to sewer conversion projects. So again, just really an exciting time to have that. We also have been allocated $1 billion for a brand new drinking water and wastewater arrearages program. So again, an outgrowth of the, you know, the ability, the COVID pandemic and the difficulty in folks not being able to pay their utility bills. And so we're rapidly working on a survey to figure out how what the needs are and to get that money out actually within the next, before the end of the year. So I think it'll be the fastest ever that we've spent $1 billion, but I know our staff are on board and interested in helping out as many individuals as we can. So there's actually a workshop on it tomorrow, and we're considering the guidelines for that at our next board meeting on the 21st, I believe. And the last couple items are smaller, but important nonetheless. And there's about $200 million for water recycling and stormwater project investment. So we'll be figuring out exactly how best to move that money out to important projects. $30 million for investigation of PFAS and technical assistance there. And I know you're interested in PFAS and its proliferation, so it's exciting to have some more resources there to help with that daunting project on its own. And then $30 million for a new water rights management system. So again, Chair McGrath, you mentioned Felicia's comments on data. You know, we don't have the data. We're struggling with the information. We've made a lot of progress since the last drought, and we do have better data now. It's not perfect. It's not real time. It's not. We have a long ways to go, certainly. So I'm very excited that we're able to bring this new investment forward over the coming several months to really modernize our data management systems on the water management side, so we can make these types of decisions more quickly and from a more informed position than we are currently today. So a lot going on, very exciting. And the last thing I just wanted to share briefly was just a plug for our Water Quality Coordinating Committee meeting, which is coming up in October. And it will be both a celebration of the last 50 years since the passage of the Clean Water Act, and also a forward look at the next 50 years and what we at the State Water Board and Regional Water Boards can and should be thinking about. And I'm sure climate change is going to be a big topic of discussion at that. And so just encourage, you know, it's all virtual, obviously. So encourage all of you, if you can, find time in your schedules to participate in that discussion. So I think I'll leave it at that and happy to take any questions.
Thank you for the comprehensive report and reminding me that I've been in this field for 49 years since the Clean Water Act passed, and I was an intern at EPA. Questions? Thanks for the comprehensive report, and particularly all the information on how our predictions for runoff have not come to pass, and how much of that is the antecedent conditions and how much of that is climate change remains to be determined. But thanks so much for that. Questions by the board?
Alexis,
yeah. Hi. It's an unprecedented amount of money to move from Sacramento out to the receiving agencies. And I'm wondering, there's often a tension between getting money out promptly into the hands of those that are going to turn it into projects and being able to make some structural change. And I'm always mindful of the fact that we have 11,000 small drinking water systems in California. And the State Board has had some tools that are hard to use in consolidating systems. Do you think that there's the opportunity with this money going out to help small systems aggregate or consolidate? Or is it just in conflict with getting the money out fast?
Great question. And it is one that we struggle with often. And we're trying to find ways to accelerate consolidations too, because I think many of us agree that if that's an option, you know, if you've got water systems that are in close proximity to one another, and one being a larger system with safe drinking water and able to subsume the smaller that has challenges, that's the low-hanging fruit of opportunity. The problem is the institutional arrangements that are needed, getting the project, you know, ready to go and ready to build, and having that align with the funding availability. So you're absolutely right. It's something we work on a lot. It's part of the reason we did that drinking water needs assessment, was to really identify those opportunities. And that's a focus of our safe and affordable drinking water program, where we have an annual fund of $130 million. And so we're adding to that $700 million and some of our other SRF funding. And a lot of our emphasis does go to consolidation where it makes sense.
It's hard. It's just we do it one at a time, and doing it one at a time with 11,000 small systems, we'll be doing this for a long time to come. But I just think if there could be maybe a criterion in the future of loan forgiveness for very small systems, if they consolidate, you know, a little bit more of a sweetener in there. But I don't want to take time now, and I really appreciate your update. I'm looking forward to WQCC, and I hope it will be quite interactive.
Definitely. Yeah, thank you.
Other questions?
I just want to ask a clarifying question. I concur with everything Alexis just said. I just wanted to, Sean, I wasn't completely clear. The billion dollars you're trying to get out the door before the end of the year, is that the safe and affordable drinking water systems?
Well, it's all related, but no, this is for arrearages. So these are for debts that individual households, customers, water customers have accumulated over the past, since the pandemic began, essentially.
$1 billion. Okay.
$1 billion. And it'll be credits essentially to the water systems or wastewater systems themselves. And so they'll be able to clear out essentially the debt on the accounts of those folks. So that's how that'll work.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sean. And I'm going to do a little backseat here. I hope all of you are on the list from Werner Chabot, but in case you weren't, he did highlight in his most recent post the negotiations going on this week in Sacramento about the trailer bill. In SB 155, there's nearly $2 billion in climate resilience funding, including some specific funding for nature-based solutions, which might be real useful for places like Western Contra Costa County, where they're talking about a multi-purpose levee with habitat value. There's also SB 170, which has funding for vulnerable communities and local assistance and implementing the fifth climate change assessment. So you can always follow up on those. They haven't passed or been signed, but there's certainly going to be some money that comes into this. Our lane will be only a portion of this, but the sooner we figure out what useful things we can do in partnership with others, the better we can be. So with that, I'd like to move on to Michael and his report.
Thank you, Chair. I want to just highlight a couple of things since we didn't have a board meeting in August. We did have an August executive officer's report, and we had a fairly thorough update on the status of the Caltrans cease and desist order work. I'm happy to report that they've made a lot of progress in their projects with local government. They're going to need these projects in order to meet their targets, their June 2022 targets. They've got 18 agreements with local government, and they've been able to apply $55 million to those. So that's going to contribute significantly to their ability to meet their target, which was something that the board had asked us to report back on when we had approved their work plan in the spring. There are still things we're working out with them on the feasibility of, you know, putting structural devices into certain rights of way and the use of alternative compliance methods like enhanced maintenance. But we're working through those issues. Staff is meeting with Caltrans on a monthly basis, and there's an exciting opportunity we'll be hearing more about. We may bring it back as an executive officer's report at some point in the fall regarding some use of artificial intelligence to assess relative trash levels in different rights of way. These are the visual assessment work that's required under the order, and they may be able to figure out a way to do that more efficiently. So we'll report back more on that later, but I just wanted to make sure that the board was aware that we have provided that update. Caltrans is making progress. Staff is working very closely with them, and we will report back likely at the end of the year or early into 2022 after we get their work plan in December. There's also an important, interesting item in last month's executive officer's report on Highway 37. There are multiple stakeholders that are closely tracking this, and we're working in partnership with other regulatory agencies, Caltrans, MTA, and some local government officials as the options for designing this really important roadway, which has the potential to be able to really improve the hydrology in the North Bay and the interconnectedness of the North Bay with the waterways that flow down and into it. So we'll be keeping the board apprised of that, but this was kind of a first opportunity for the board to understand what kind of the framework of that project is. This month's executive officer's report, we had a little item on diesel spills, and it prompted a conversation that I had with board member Hacker about enforcement. So when we have these smaller spills and parties are responsible and they address the spill promptly and there are no environmental impacts, generally we use our enforcement discretion. We have limited enforcement resources, so we're really going after big problems with those resources where we see prompt response and prompt compliance. We tend to use our enforcement discretion. We provided those two examples. Those were both examples of problems where the dischargers quickly addressed the small diesel spills as examples. But I just wanted to contextualize that from an enforcement perspective. And then lastly, highlight again the challenges that our SSOs are having in the SSO item with these wipes that people are flushing that have resulted and continue to, increase the number of sanitary sewer overflows, and that it's an ongoing problem. There's a lot of effort to message around it, and we're certainly trying to do our part with social media, but I just want to point out that it is an ongoing issue. And then a couple of big meetings on the horizon. State of the Estuary Conference is coming up on October the 1st. I'll be sending around the information for folks to sign up for that. It's a one-day virtual conference. The annual RMP meeting, that's the Regional Monitoring Program, is October the 14th. So if you're feeling energy after our two-day October board meeting and you want to be on another all-day Zoom meeting, I would recommend the RMP. It's a great way to learn about the issues that group is facing. We have a really innovative monitoring program, as you all know. It's the envy of a number of other of my regional board colleagues, and it's a great opportunity to learn. I'll stop there, and I think hand it back to the chair, unless there are questions.
Questions for Mike?
No, I don't have a question, but I forgot to say something earlier in Mike's report reminded me, and it has to do with social media. I don't know how many other people are watching the board on Instagram, but it has just gotten better and better and better and more relevant and great photos. And I know they've done some things about the wipes. I would say keep them coming, the more things that consumers can do that the average person in our region can do to contribute to positive water quality. And I really appreciate it. But anyway, I think the team is just doing a great job with Instagram, and hope everybody will follow it. Yeah.
Well, thank you. I mean, I appreciate you. You gave us some great coaching last year. So, we're trying to put it to good use.
So that brings us to item 6. Uncontested calendar, and I need to do the swearing in at this point. All relevant evidence that any person desires to be considered by this board must be introduced at this hearing, first by the board staff, second by the discharger, third by public agencies, and fourth by any other interested parties. The board and board counsel may ask questions to clarify the testimony of a witness at any time. Cross-examinations of any witness by others will be allowed following completion of direct testimony by all persons. Each person testifying will commence by stating his or her name, whom he or she represents, and whether or not he or she took the oath to tell the truth. The hearings will not be conducted according to technical rules of evidence. The board will accept any evidence or testimony that is reasonably relevant to the issues. All board files, exhibits, and agenda materials pertaining to this matter will be made part of the record of this process. Additional written material will be made part of the record at the discretion of the board. Those wishing to testify in the hearing will now raise their hands. I'm not expecting anybody to rise from their chairs. Do you promise to tell the truth? It does seem a little overkill for our uncontested item, but we'll move to that now. Michael.
Yeah, thanks. So we have the sanitary district number 5 of Marin County. This Paradise Cove treatment plant and collection system is out in Tiburon in Marin County. It's a relative to the most of the plants that we permit collection systems. It's very small. It serves a residential community. They have a very good compliance record, as indicated in the report, and they're planning to make some upgrades. In particular, their disinfection system. They're going to move from using chlorine to a UV system. We received no comments from the public on the tentative order, and I'm happy to answer questions. I would recommend adoption by the board.
Guy, before I go to the board, are there any raised hands in the audience for testimony? Nope. They're not. So I'll return it to the board. Are there any questions or comments? Board Member Hecker.
That every time we renew an NPDES discharge permit, there's the opportunity to look at the extent to which a system is taking advantage of water reuse and recycling. And in this case, we have a very small system, but it also has the luxury of being a domestic-only kind of influent. And so they don't have to contend with industrial pollutants and the like. And I'm just encouraging them to consider some reasonable approach to bringing a measure of water recycling. When you think of the Tiburon Peninsula, there's plenty of opportunity for them to use some measure of effluent. And I don't mean for it to be a very expensive thing. I just think there's always the opportunity in California for water reuse and recycling. And there's no lack of money to help pay for that.
As we heard from Board Member McGuire.
I'm just going to yet again say thank you, Alexis. I think we should be asking this question as well every single time. And maybe it can even be part of our standard process, but what are the opportunities for and your plans for recycled water? I think it's a great question.
I really commend them for investing in changing over their disinfection system, and that may be something that also helps them with the ability to consider what would be a modest packaged recycling reuse purple pipe option here.
Other board members?
We will certainly pass that along.
I'm going to demur a little bit, at least at this time. While I agree that we should encourage funding for that, it's a very small system. And the thing that I was very impressed in, I always check performance, is we have a system. And package treatment plants throughout the state, in my experience, have been problematic from time to time and difficult to manage for small communities in terms of the cost. This one has a remarkable record. It's working very, very well, which means that its effluent might be much more suitable. But it also has no sanitary sewer overflows. So I don't want to do anything about it at this time, but perhaps a message to them to look into it for the next time would be appropriate. Is that satisfactory to you, Board Member Hacker?
It certainly is. I had a follow-up question for staff that we'll handle offline about lab performance, because you may notice in Section F, the fact sheet, there was a very large number of data values that were unreported. And I just want to make sure that that high-quality effluent is, in fact, high-quality effluent, and we'll deal with that offline. But I'm fine with what you suggest, Chair McGrath.
And not lack of data. Good point. I missed that. Thank you. With that, if there's no further discussions, can I have a motion to approve the uncontested calendar?
Move to approve.
I'll second.
All right. Guy, would you call the roll, please?
Board Member Young?
Aye.
Board Member Gunther?
Aye.
Board Member Hacker?
Aye.
Board Member Kissinger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Batty?
Aye.
And Chair McGrath?
Aye. With that, I'm going to suggest we take about a five-minute break. I usually let you go down the hall a little sooner than this, but I think we might spend some more time on the next item, so let's take a five-minute break.
Okay, Chair McGrath, the floor is yours.
All right, thank you all. We're back in session, and we're on item number 7, enforcement. Param and Amandeep Dhillon, assessor's parcel. This hearing is intended to consider a resolution authorizing referral to the Attorney General. This is not, I believe, a factual determination. The board had a very extensive hearing and found the violation and adopted an order. This question is what to do at this point. So in order to provide us quality advice on the processes for this, I'm going to turn to Michael Montgomery first and our attorney second to advise us on how to approach this in terms of our procedures, which are different than those that we see in a normal enforcement action where the functions are separated. Michael?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I'm going to introduce Cleek Carlton in a minute to give a presentation for the enforcement team. But as you pointed out, we're not following your typical formal hearing procedures for enforcement. The enforcement team has proposed this referral, a resolution to refer a follow-on enforcement matter from the earlier ACL penalty that the board had adopted back in November. And Yuri Wan and I, counsel, are advising the board on this. You can ask enforcement staff clarifying questions, but you can't really ask about the detailed facts related to the enforcement case or its merits, because that would imply that you're actually hearing the case. And the idea here is that we're referring it on to the AG for formal enforcement action. So hopefully that's clear. And I'll hand it over to Yuri to add any additional advice to that.
Thanks, Mike. Good morning, board members. So that's exactly right. The board is not deciding the merits of an enforcement case today. It's just deciding whether to refer this case to the Attorney General's office for judicial enforcement. And that it could include something like an injunction to compel the discharger to comply with the cleanup and abatement order, or it could result in additional civil liabilities for not complying with the cleanup and abatement order. As for the unpaid civil liability from last year, that's not something that we need to go to the Attorney General's office to recoup. We can go to a superior court and convert that into a judgment. So that's a separate issue. And so this is pretty a simple case of deciding whether to refer. And the reason why you're here to decide this is because the water code requires that if we want to refer a civil liability case to enforce a cleanup and abatement order, you have to have a hearing and give notice to the discharger for that referral. Normally, when we refer cases outside that context, we just refer without having a hearing. But this is unusual in that we have the potential for a civil liability of the cleanup of abatement order violations, and that's why we're here.
Thank you, Yuri. And the reason behind this is that there is not a successful implementation of the board's order. So there are compliance issues with the board's order, which is adopted. Is that correct? Yes,
correct.
Okay.
There was a cleanup and abatement order issued last year, and it has not been complied with.
And if there was compliance, we wouldn't be here. We would be administering that compliance, correct?
Correct.
All right. With that, I'll bring it back to Michael, and I believe he'll have Cleet Carlton give us the staff presentation.
Thank you. Cleet, you want to proceed?
Yes, thank you, Mike. If Guy can go ahead and pull up the presentation. Okay, can just make sure that you can hear me. Great. Good morning, Chair McGrath and members of the board. My name is Cleet Carlton, and I took the oath. I'm an engineering geologist with the Regional Water Board. Today, on behalf of the enforcement staff, I'm asking you to refer the Parham and Amandeep Dillon case to the State Attorney General. Next slide, please. Referral to the Attorney General will expand the options we have to compel compliance, and it will allow us to consolidate efforts with the San Francisco Bay Conservation and Development Commission, or BCDC, which has similar restoration interests and compliance issues with the Dillons. A referral to the Attorney General would allow the executive officer to seek enforcement against the Dillons through the courts. This measure is needed to achieve compliance with our orders by elevating enforcement as needed. Our case for requesting this referral is simple and based on the following. One, the Dillons failed to pay an administrative civil liability the board imposed in November 2020 for their failure to submit technical reports. Two, the Dillons failed to comply with the requirements of a cleanup and abatement order issued in May 2021. And three, referral to the Attorney General would allow us to coordinate compliance and enforcement with BCDC, which has already referred a case against the Dillons to the Attorney General. I will now provide some background on the property. Next slide, please. The Dillon property is a 7.6-acre parcel outlined in red on this slide, located in the western portion of Vallejo, across Highway 29 from the North Lagoon of the White Slough, which is tidally connected to the bay through Napa River. Next slide, please. About 5 acres of the Dillon property contains protected wetlands designated as the East Lagoon of White Slough. In 1990, the state legislature passed the White Slough Protection and Development Act to protect the White Slough. The law required specific area plans, and in 1996, the White Slough Specific Area Plan was developed. The specific area plan identified the East Lagoon as a muted tidal seasonal wetland. The upper illustration is from the specific area plan and shows the wetland areas protected by implementation of the plan as the shaded areas that extend onto the Dillon property. In 1999, the city of Vallejo implemented part of the plan by rezoning the property for resource conservation and changed its general plan designation from retail to wetlands. The lower photo shows wetlands at the Dillon property looking north from the highway in March 2019, prior to the filling and grading. Next slide, please. According to the Dillon's consultant, the Dillon's had approximately 7,000 cubic yards of fill placed on their property in October and November of 2019. The fill was from an unknown source. Using the October 31, 2019 aerial photo on the right, we estimated that fill and grading occurred over 4.4 acres of the property, as shown by the dashed red line. This photo was taken near the end of the dry season and shows some of the piles of dirt brought to the property by dump trucks, like the one seen in the photo in the upper left. The photo in the lower left was taken in December 2019 and shows dirt graded into the area of protected wetlands. The Dillons did not obtain a construction stormwater permit, nor file a report of waste discharge with the Water Board. We needed more information about the unauthorized activities and the extent of wetlands before the fill and grading to determine actions necessary to apply the state's no net loss wetlands policy. The Dillons were required to submit technical reports pursuant to Water Code Section 13267 to document their work, delineate wetlands, and assess damage. But the Dillons failed to submit the technical reports. Next slide, please. We brought a complaint for failure to submit the technical reports to the board in November 2020, and the board imposed an administrative civil liability against the Dillons in the amount of $61,374. The Dillons petitioned the administrative civil liability order to the state board in December 2020, but it was dismissed in March 2021. We informed the Dillons of the responsibility to pay the civil liability in May and June. The Dillons have not paid the civil liability, which was due about 6 months ago. Next slide, please. The cleanup and abatement order issued in May 2021 required wetland restoration. Requirements were scheduled to get corrective actions started before the coming wet season. Corrective actions included the removal of concrete, shown here, from the end of a storm drain in the East Lagoon that the Dillons plugged back in November 2020. The first requirement of the cleanup and abatement order, due by July 1st, was to document unauthorized construction activities and impacts to wetlands and waters of the state at the property. The Dillons hired a consultant and submitted a report, but it was incomplete and deficient. It did not include characterization of or a sampling plan for the fill and did not properly document wetland conditions. While we continue to engage with the Dillons and their consultants and provide feedback on what is needed to comply, we have not received an adequate report and the deadline to submit a corrective action work plan has passed. As a result, restoration is delayed and the Dillons are not on schedule as set forth in the order to repair the damaged wetlands before the coming wet season. Next slide, please. The board has taken many of the actions available to it under the Water Code to compel compliance. Adoption of the resolution would refer enforcement to the Attorney General. An Attorney General referral would be the next step in progressive enforcement as it opens new enforcement options, including more monetary penalties, injunctions, and other remedies through the courts as needed to compel compliance and restore the property. We publicly noticed and sent the tentative resolution to the Dillons and other interested parties for a 30-day comment period. We only received comments from BCDC in support of the tentative resolution. Next slide, please. In summary, we have been working with the Dillons to restore wetlands at their property for nearly 2 years. Each year that passes further degrades wetland habitat, and with the potential for permanent damage to wetlands, soils, and roots that allow for regrowth. A referral to the Attorney General will expand the options we have to compel compliance, and it will allow us to consolidate our efforts with BCDC, which has similar restoration interests and compliance issues with the Dillons. We recommend that the board adopt the tentative resolution and refer enforcement to the Attorney General so that we can most efficiently restore the property to the way it appears in this slide.
Do we have questions of the staff from the board?
I have a couple questions.
Go ahead, Bill.
Cleet, to what degree, you mentioned that the respondent to this, to the CAO and his consultant have been, you've been in contact with them. To what degree has the our action today been explained to them? To what degree have they responded in any substantive fashion?
I'm sorry, is that in the response to the resolution? Because we didn't get any comments on the resolution, or is it to the requirements of the CAO?
I'm sorry, to the resolution, the referral we're proposing to take. To what degree have you talked about it with them, the consultant, as well as the Dillons, about what this means? What, you know, what response have they gotten from them?
I don't believe we've gotten any direct response from them. We sent them the resolution as a tentative resolution back in July, and we've provided reminders of them of the hearing back in August.
Yeah, you said in your presentation, you know, you've been in touch with the Dillons and their consultant. So, what have the interactions been with them?
Emails and meetings online with the Dillons and their consultant. Going over what we informed them were deficiencies in their report.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Thanks, Clay.
So are the Dillons here to make a statement?
Yes. Sorry, Clay.
The Dillons are here. Good. Before I go to them, I do have one question for Clay. Recital number 14, recital number H on page 2 of the draft resolution talks about a report, two reports submitted by Galloway Enterprises, and an estimate of 0.27 acres of impact. I've looked at the pictures and the aerial photos, both that was that were provided today and at the previous November hearing, in some detail. It appears to me and that the impact is far greater than that. And I'd like you to comment on, first of all, how you arrived at the figure of, I think, 4.3 acres of impact, Phil, that you concluded. And second, what methodological magic was used to limit the impact to 0.27 acres?
Well, the I believe it was 4.4 acres that I cited before was that reflects the total disturbed area. So that would be the total area that we estimated of the grading and the fill combined. And that was based on a rather fortuitous October 31st, 2019 aerial photo So it was just basically an aerial photo observation for that aspect.
So it's possible that some of that was not indeed a wetland because there had not been a previous delineation that was detailed, correct?
It's possible.
Okay. Well, we're not sure one way or the other. We're pretty sure that the disturbance area was 4.4 acres. There's plenty of evidence to that, correct?
Correct.
Okay. How did they arrive at 0.27 acres? I mean, I just find that astonishing given the clear pictures of flooding on the site.
That's a good question. I'm not sure if I should punt that to Agnes. It definitely has to do with the methodology that they use, the three-point methodology for determining whether something's a wetland or not. Agnes, do you want to elaborate on that?
Sure. Yeah, we've had some correspondence with the Dillons and their consultant on their wetland delineation methodology. Some of the deficiencies have to do with the fact that they did not consider that the site has been under drought conditions for a significant period of time. Other deficiencies in the report are because they could not observe indicators of wetland hydrology or wetland vegetation in the fill and grading areas because those areas were disturbed. And so because they couldn't see those indicators or collect data on those indicators, they concluded those areas were not wetlands, which we don't agree with. So those are some of the details we're working out with them on their delineation methods.
Any other questions from the board before I turn to public comment?
I just have a quick one, and it's maybe along the same lines as Cleve. The photo of the area inundated. When is that from?
The aerial photo?
Photograph. The photograph that.
Oh, on the final slide.
Yes.
That was from March of 2019. It's actually a Google Maps image.
Great. Thank you.
All right. So it's appropriate at this time to hear from the discharger. Mr. Dillon, are you present?
Mr. Dillon has been promoted to panelist and can unmute himself now.
Mr. Dillon, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
We can. Go ahead. Remember, this is only about whether or not to refer this to the Attorney General. We've already found you in violation.
I understand. Well, first of all, I wasn't aware of this meeting. I got the email yesterday at the end of the day from Mr. Carlton that there was a meeting today. I was totally unaware of that. So I had no time to prepare. The picture you keep seeing on the slide that Mr. Carlton has put up many times, that is a picture, a Google picture that was, I don't know, he says March 2019. It doesn't show what's on the property right now. The property is totally dry. And the prosecution is putting up a picture that is totally incorrect. After I closed, I had the right as a property owner to close the storm drain that was dumping contaminated water onto my property. After that was closed, there was after the rainy season, this last rainy season, there was hardly any water on the property. It was like there's no water on the property. So the whole wetland issue was because there was illegal discharge from this storm drain. And with the closure of this drain, it's all disappeared. Prosecution is exaggerating what is on the site and what's on their report. I wish you could all go see, look at the property, and then decide what's there. I did not realize that my consultant had given an estimation of how much fill was put on the property. And I talked to her yesterday, and I wasn't aware that the prosecution had this estimation. And that estimation is totally wrong. There is no way that so much dirt was put on the property. So I'm going to challenge that, that estimation by Galloway, Ms. Gregg, is totally incorrect. I don't know what method she used to calculate that. That amount would be from more than 500 trucks dumping on the property. And that was not the case at all. I don't know exactly because I live so far away. I don't know how many trucks, but it was nothing. I mean, it's not anywhere close to that. My next point is that I've been working very hard. I have hired a soils person to do the sampling on the property to figure out what was the quality of the dirt. I have spent a lot of money to hire the consultant, and now the soils geologist that they are working on. I had provided the first technical reports well before they were due. And every time anything is submitted to the prosecution team, they tell us that it's not acceptable. It's not good enough. It's not to their taste. And they send it back. And I'm doing everything I can in my power to make this problem go away out of my life because I am tired of it. And I have done everything they have asked me to do. So I go back to the consultant and I gave them, you know, they get the same comments. They are on the email and they've been working on it. So this when we send them the revised technical reports, and that was just 2-3 days ago, they said it's not good enough. So my consultant is working on it again. So I don't understand when we are complying, I am complying, the consultant is currently working on their last comments. I don't see any reason to refer me to an attorney general. I mean, if I wasn't complying with your request, I can understand that. And when you're taking so much time asking to revise those technical reports, how could I comply with your CAO on time? I mean, you're taking your sweet time to read those revised reports, and by the time you tell me that we need to, you know, do whatever you require, it takes time. So if I was not responding, I can understand, you know, referring me to Attorney General, but we are working actively on it. And the closure of the storm drain, as a property owner, I had the right to do that. And the fact that it is in the order, it's an illegal act to ask me to open this storm drain and allow the contaminated water on my property. This is a violation of my property rights. And Vallejo Sanitation and Flood Control, they have no right. They don't have an easement. They don't have any covenants to drain that water, contaminated water, onto my property. So the order in itself is not valid because it is asking me to do something illegal. I wish I had more time to prepare, but I mean, I joined the meeting while it was still in progress. So prosecution is exaggerating, showing you the picture with blue water. It's not the case. They should show the picture that is today, what is on the property today. That's all I have to say.
Thank you, Mr. Dillon. We'll bring it back to the board. Any questions of Mr. Dillon?
Chair McGrath.
Yes.
My name's Dan Kipp, and I'm one of the attorneys for the prosecution team. If I may, just to address one of Mr. Dillon's points, he was given notice of this meeting today on July 14th, as well as an email on August 16th, which he replied to, which confirms his receipt of it.
Thank you, Dan.
Can I respond, sir?
Mr. Dillon, we've taken your testimony. Okay. You want to revisit some of the aspects of the facts on this, which are not under debate. The question here is performance towards compliance, and that's the basis of the board's consideration here.
Thank you.
Did I misstate that in any way, Yuri or Dan?
Yeah, the board's task is whether to refer the matter to the AG's office, not to determine the merits of any enforcement action. So the relevant facts are, you know, did Mr. Dillon and his wife not comply with the cleanup and abatement order such that progressive enforcement is warranted, such as enforcement by the Attorney General's office? Mr. Dillon said that he has been complied. However, I believe Mr. Carlton mentioned that there was a corrective action report that was due August 16th of this year, and that has not been submitted.
I would like to respond to that. That corrective action plan cannot be presented till the consultant. The report that consultant has given you, you agree with it. Unless you agree with the technical reports, we cannot move forward. The corrective action plan can only be put in place if you are done with the technical reports.
All right, I'm going to go back to the board. I have some comments at the end, but I'll look for questions or comments from the board.
I'll make a quick comment. And this is to Mr. Dillon. You know, Mr. Dillon, you're a very appealing, compelling person. We're very moved by your presentation. When we were last together, I think it was November last year, we reduced the civil penalty because we were sympathetic to your circumstances. I've been on the board a long time at this point. One of the longest duration people on the board at this point. And, you know, I know our staff to be reasonable, thoughtful, and to work with parties. And I just, you know, I hear the case you're making doesn't square with the people that I know are on the staff at the board. I don't think there's any alternative but to refer it to the Attorney General's office for further action, other than to suggest to you that, you know, this is not a one-way road. You can turn things around. You have lots of explanations for why things haven't gotten done. You said you want to make things right. You can still make things right, but you need to work with the Water Board staff, or your consultant needs to work with the Water Board staff. You don't need to respond to this. But I think you do need to recognize you can fix this problem, but it's in your hands. Those are my comments.
So I'm going to support this referral to the Attorney General. Mr. Dillon, perhaps in all good faith, has a misunderstanding of what his rights are with respect to other people in the watershed that are affected. He has asked us today to look at the property today and find that the wetlands that he eliminated without permits no longer exist, and therefore the delineation and any remedy should benefit from his activity without permits. That's not a compelling argument. The second argument he's made is that he has a right to close a storm drain, and that's part of his property rights. Just recalling the recital of facts from the original item, no construction permits from the city of the city here were obtained, and the idea that a storm drain and an easement for a storm drain can somehow be eliminated, and that function can be eliminated and not affect any other person is just simply wrong. Water runs downhill through a series of courses, and to eliminate one of those courses is to damage a drainage that will affect other parties. Your rights are not absolute as with respect to other parties. Now, you could have brought factual information that said that wouldn't in fact occur, but that's not occurred. Now, we're not debating the facts, but we are debating the conclusion that you've made that you have an absolute right to close that. I believe that's factually incorrect. No permits were obtained with respect. So, I believe you've had substantive notice of the regulatory restrictions on this from the Regional Water Quality Control Board, from BCDC, and from local government. You've ignored those. The last point I want to make is that you've indicated that you don't believe that there was 7,000 cubic yards of fill placed on the property, but you have no records for this activity that would support that. And we're going to rely on what we see in visual evidence, which was fairly clear that there was a large amount of fill put on this property. And the fact that the low areas have been filled without permits and water's been cut off, again, without permits, does not now create a presumption that there was no damage done. So I'm going to support this referral. I'll turn to the rest of the board for any comments or a recommendation or. So Michael, we have your recommendation before us to refer this. Can I get a motion?
I'll move.
By Board Member Kissinger.
Second
by Board Member Jane Batty. Guy, would you call the roll, please?
Board Member Young?
Aye.
Board Member Gunther?
Aye.
Board Member Hacker?
Aye.
Board Member Kissinger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Batty?
Yes.
And Chair McGrath?
Aye. So ordered. All right. Thank you, staff. Thank you, Mr. And that brings us to the informational item, statewide, the winery process water. Michael?
Yeah. Thank you, Chair. So we have a excellent presentation today. You know, as those of you that have been on a board a while know that we were preparing our own regional order to regulate winery waste water discharges a number of years ago, prior to my arrival as executive officer. And there was a push for a statewide order to address this. A number of other regions had adopted their own orders. And we've been heavily involved in it. And we've worked very closely with State Board. It took a while to get it done, but we're happy that it came to a conclusion that addressed a lot of our interests as a region. This is an important order for us, for our region, and we're going to be closely involved in the rollout of the order And I felt like it would be State Board offered to do the briefing, which I'm really thankful for. And I felt like it would be helpful for the board to understand the implications, workload implications, the resource implications, and our intent to, because we forged a really strong relationship with the winery community through the vineyards permit and through our other stormwater permitting programs, we really want to make sure that we roll this out in a way that maximizes compliance and provides assistance to the winery business community as they begin to apply for coverage under this order. So we have with us from the State Board, Laura Woodrip, and she will be presenting. Welcome, Laurel. We also have following, we have sort of a sequence of speakers. So I'll introduce them all. Next will be Kim Withrow from Napa County. Napa is been a very close regulatory partner in our work with the wine industry. And then closing out, we'll have Melissa Gunther from our Watershed Division, who has been instrumental and actually received an award for her work from State Board in supporting this effort, the statewide effort. So congratulations to her. And so that'll be our order of speakers. And I'll go ahead and hand it off to Laurel.
Thank you so much for that introduction. I believe that Melissa was going to do some of the intro slides.
Okay.
A little bit of a switch up there, given the detailed information. Thank you for pulling the slides up.
Great. I will, I'll jump in here then, Laurel. Let's see. Okay. Well, good morning, Chair McGrath and members of the board. My name is Melissa Gunter, and I work as a water resource control engineer in our watershed management division. As you know, I'm joined here with Laura Woodrip, who supervises the State Water Board's waste discharge requirements unit. And although he's not presenting today, Scott Couch is also with us, supervising geologist who oversees the State Water Board's larger groundwater protection section. And then, as Mike mentioned, Kim Withrow from Napa County will join us this morning to share more about the county's winery program. So I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to present on the general waste discharge requirements for winery process water that were adopted by the State Water Board in January of this year. And just to note that we will refer throughout this presentation to the order as the statewide order, the order, or the general order. And also just a quick, real quick shout out. Earlier in the meeting, we had talked about sanitary district number 5 of Marin County. Just wanted to say that I also work in recycled water, and just to give a little shout out that they did request approval to use the recycled water for cleaning sanitary sewers earlier, like April this year, kind of before the drought, right when it was kicking off. So just want to do a little plug before I jump back to wineries. Okay. Next slide. Cool. So I'll start today's presentation by sharing more about the intent of the order and summarizing winery processed water sources, their characteristics, and discharge methods. And then State Board staff will then describe the order structure and requirements along with the next steps now that the order's been adopted. And then Napa County will continue to tell the story of wineries in our region by discussing their winery program. And then I'll wrap it back up with some highlights about our regional plan to implement the order. Next slide. So the statewide order was designed to protect groundwater and beneficial uses such as drinking water supply. It also streamlines the permitting of winery process water discharges to land by setting a consistent set of requirements statewide, and it supports our and other regions' efforts to efficiently allocate our limited resources to regulate these discharges. The order establishes requirements statewide for these discharges. That includes expected pollutant control practices, effluent and loading limits, and a monitoring program. And the monitoring program focuses on the primary constituents of concern in winery process water, salinity, nitrogen, and biochemical oxygen demand. And I'll discuss those a little further in this presentation as well. Next slide. Winery processed water is generated during wine production, which includes activities such as crushing and pressing of the grapes, and the juice extraction is shown in the upper left image. The fermentation, as indicated in the upper right figure. Clarification and bottling is in the lower left. And then residuals, draining, and filter washing. It's also generated from cleaning operations and the sanitation of equipment, tanks, and barrels. And other sources of processed water are water softener regeneration brine and boiler or cooling tower blowdown. So the crush is the time period when grapes are harvested and pressed, and it's a key step in the production and generates generally the most processed water. And that typically occurs from mid-August to early November for about 45 to 75 days, though of course this does vary by winery and location. And some wineries operate year-round, generating processed water during the off-season from blending, bottling, and cleaning. And then processed water's quality of it does vary based on the source water quality, the facility operations, and the cleaning chemicals utilized. And so the water quality and the volume also vary seasonally, with the highest flows and highest constituent concentrations generated during crush. Next slide. Right. Winery processed water contains a range of constituents. As I previously stated, the order addresses salinity, nitrogen, and the form nitrate, and biochemical oxygen demand, or BOD, as the water quality parameters of concern. So grape juice, wine, and pumice, which is the pulpy residue remaining after the grapes are crushed, and the cleaning chemicals can contribute nitrogen, BOD, and salinity. So the source water may also be a source of salinity and can sometimes contribute to the processed water. And then the order addresses potential impacts to groundwater. Beneficial uses from these constituents, where nitrates and salts can impact the supply water. The order also includes BOD requirements to manage odors and conditions that can lead to groundwater impacts. And of the different types of salts, elevated levels of fixed dissolved solids have a greater potential to impact soil and reach groundwater. The fixed dissolved solids are dissolved solids that are generally not biodegradable and thus can accumulate in the soil. And then it's also difficult and can be costly to remove the salt from the solution. Thus, there's source control practices are important and are included in the order, which Laura will speak more to later in the presentation. And then nitrogen from processed water goes through a chemical and biological transformations in the soil. The processed water generally has low levels of nitrate and higher concentrations of other forms of nitrogen, such as ammonia and organic nitrogen, which can convert, though, to nitrate in the soil. And then nitrate may be leached below the root zone by percolation and then can pose health concerns when elevated in drinking water. And then lastly, the BOD, there's the oxygen consuming organic material is measured as BOD, and the excessive BOD loading can lead to depletion of oxygen in the soil, which in turn slows the soil's natural wastewater treatment processes by clogging the soil with organic matter and potentially suspended solids and can cause odors. And the low oxygen conditions them could also mobilize naturally occurring metals. All right, next slide. All right, so wineries can discharge processed water through various methods. The most typical methods are addressed with method-specific order requirements, and these include the discharge of winery processed water below the land surface, such as from a septic tank to a leach field, as shown in the lower left image, or via reuse for irrigation via distribution methods, such as spray or drip irrigation or subsurface tile. And wineries can also discharge to land in areas that don't have a crop or discharge to a pond or a tank. So depending on the disposal system, ponds and or tanks, such as septic or treatment tanks, are used for treatment and storage of processed water. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Laurel Wardrip with the State Board, and then she's going to dive into more details about the order. Next slide.
Thank you, Melissa. Very good introduction to the winery process water. The order development and adoption took over 5 years and included the release of the administrative and public drafts, addressing public comments on those drafts, several staff workshops, and the State Water Board's adoption meeting on January 20th, 2021. This slide here shows the timeline after adoption, and the blue arrow shows where we are today. I want to also note the State Board Fee Unit took the winery fee schedule to the State Board in July, July 6th is shown on the slide, and fees were adopted based on the size of the winery as well as the volume of wastewater being produced. We're now transitioning into the preliminary enrollment process for wineries, and that process is in three phases, where the beginning phase is the notification to the wineries, and when we're allowing the PDF applications, as well as some of those emailed type of application documents. And then during phase two, we anticipate on having an interim online notice of intent and application process. And finally, during phase three, over the next few years, we'll have a final online notice of intent and enrollment process similar to what we have in the application enrollment process for the cannabis policy and waste discharge requirements. And our goal is to have the water quality monitoring data required by the order to be submitted into the GeoTracker database. Next slide, please. So California has a lot of wineries, and the map at the left shows the general distribution of these in California. There are many of them, and they are actually located in every regional board jurisdiction, although some are more weighted in some jurisdictions than others. The order is intended to cover most of these wineries. However, the largest wineries will remain regulated under individual orders due to their size. For example, wineries that are producing over 15 million gallons of processed water are not eligible for this order. And then in some cases where they have site characteristics requiring more protective water quality measures. And then on the smaller end of the scale, some wineries will not be required to enroll due to their low volume of processed water produced, and local requirements or other regulatory measures like a waiver may still apply in some areas of the state or regions. We roughly estimate, and it is a rough estimate, that about 1,500 wineries will need to enroll in the statewide order over the next few years. And as an aside, the order covers facilities producing wine or grape juice and does not include distilleries or breweries. Regions will continue to address those through their usual permitting practices. Next slide, please. As shown on this slide, there are three enrollment categories for wineries in the statewide order: existing wineries without waste discharge requirements, or WDRs, existing wineries with WDRs, and that means some sort of order or waiver covering their discharges, and then new wineries that are not yet in operation. I'll go over these categories, the wineries tier approach, and the associated requirements in the next few slides. So the first bucket: existing wineries without WDRs must submit a notice of intent and technical report by January 20th, 2024. With that application, they can propose up to a 5-year schedule to come into compliance with the order, beginning with the regional board issuing the notice of applicability for order coverage. The order also includes specific schedules for technical requirements such as groundwater monitoring or subsurface disposal system upgrades to comply. The second category is existing wineries that currently have general WDRs, conditional waivers, or individual WDRs. And those wineries will need to work with the regional boards on enrollment, given some of the scenarios we talked about in the previous slide. And then under the third category, new wineries should be designed for order compliance before they begin to operate, and they're required to apply for coverage at least 180 days before they have the potential to discharge. Next slide, please. All right, so let me tell you about the order's tier structure. And this tier structure is used to set the fees and the requirements based on the winery size and estimated potential threats to water quality. As you can see on the slide, there's an exempt category and then four regulatory tiers. The order establishes this exempt category for small wineries producing 10,000 gallons of wastewater or less per year, and there's no fee, no enrollment, or registration required. The regulatory facility tiers start at over 10,000 gallons to 15 million gallons of processed water produced per year. The order uses gallons of processed water produced versus volume of wine produced in an effort to focus on the potential discharges to land that can impact water quality instead of focusing on the volume of a product made by a winery. Many comments and discussions revolved around the tier cutoffs and requirements, and the adopted tiers were arrived at through a review of public input, the requirements in existing regional orders or individual orders, and then the estimated potential threat to water quality. The adopted annual fee schedule includes a tiered range from $750 to $19,000 a year per facility, depending on the annual gallons of processed water produced, and includes a 10% reduction for enrollment in a water board accepted sustainability program and a 50% fee reduction for wineries overseen by a water board accepted local agency oversight program. This slide also shows some examples of winery facilities compared in size from small, maybe a tier one or two to the left, to a large, possibly a tier four winery. As you see, the complexity increases with the size of the winery in most cases. And the order includes specific tiered requirements that are not covered in detail today, but generally the requirements are more stringent the larger the winery or tier. However, the basic tiered requirements are as follows. So all tier one through four wineries must enroll. They must complete required reporting, such as an annual report, comply with the discharge prohibition, such as the discharge of untreated processed water, so a bypass of the treatment systems prohibited to discharge to land, and then address systems disposing of commingled and domestic processed water. The order requires some upgrades to address that. And then the management of salts through general on-site best management practices that I discuss in later slides. All wineries are also required to manage their processed water solids, whether it's through the land application for irrigation or crop amendments, or ensuring solids are disposed of properly off-site when on-site application is not feasible. I'll now go over some of the tiered requirements. So tier one covers the smallest enrolled wineries and requires them to manage processed water treatment and disposal, generally through management practices, such as controlling odors and surface runoff. And then tier one wineries are also required to monitor the effluent flow from the winery to verify the tier. And there's not other monitoring really required for this tier. Most of the new requirements fall for wineries that are within tier two through four, where there are tier-specific monitoring requirements for the flow of the processed water from winery to land. There's facility specifications and the requirement to compare modern results to order limitations that I cover in the next slide. The general requirement categories are processed water pond requirements, where ponds must be sized to capture peak storm events and be lined to minimize the transport of untreated processed water to ground or groundwater. Land application area requirements to ensure surface disposal does not cause a nuisance, runoff, or impacts to water quality. And then subsurface disposal requirements to ensure subsurface disposal systems are maintained and operated as designed, and subsurface discharges do not cause impacts to water quality. Next slide, please. So this is where I was mentioning the tier two through four effluent limits or loading limits. The statewide order does include these limits that are applicable to tier two through four. And there's two sets of standards depending on how a winery is disposing of processed water. And it's designed to address the different water quality concerns associated with surface versus subsurface discharges. The first category is surface disposal loading limits. Wineries using processed water to irrigate crops or landscaping, like Melissa was mentioning, are required to apply waste constituents at rates that benefit crops and minimize leaching past the root zone, thus avoiding impacts to groundwater. And this is often termed agronomic rate. Compliance is demonstrated through an annual nitrogen balance to ensure loading is protective of water quality from potential nitrate impacts to drinking or other supply beneficial uses. The order also requires average BOD loading to land application areas at 100 pounds an acre per day. And this is over the course of any discharge cycle or irrigation cycle. The basis for these requirements is primarily from the regional orders in the United States Environmental Protection Agency, and they're designed to control odors, ensure conditions in the disposal field are available to foster healthy plant growth and constituent uptake, an oxygenated environment. The second category is subsurface disposal limits, and these are actual effluent limits, which include a hydraulic max loading for processed water flow to a subsurface disposal system at 1 gallon per square foot of trench per day. And the discharger using a subsurface disposal system is required to measure the treated effluent prior to discharging into the subsurface disposal area. And they're required to meet the effluent limits shown on the slide for total nitrogen, biochemical oxygen demand, and total suspended solids. And this is through a sampling average of the three most recent samples. The basis for these limits is to ensure the effluent meets the drinking water maximum contaminant levels for nitrogen, as many septic systems are not designed for nitrogen treatment, and soil treatment from the discharge prior to reaching groundwater varies significantly and is often unknown. The order also provides a groundwater monitoring option in lieu of meeting the subsurface disposal nitrogen limit. Next slide, please. So another key order area is salt control, and it's been touched on a little bit. Elevated levels of salt, including fixed dissolved solids, do have the potential to impact soil and reach groundwater, where it can impact beneficial uses such as industrial and drinking supply. So on the slide here, you see there's two buckets of all tiers, and all the tiers are required to implement general salt control practices, which are aimed at source control of the added salts for winery process and requires all tiers to implement these. Some examples of these general salt control practices are reducing the amount of chemicals used that contribute salts, and then lowering the volume of processed water by using dry cleaning methods or efficient practices. The second bucket is tier 2 through 4, which does have the applicability of the fixed dissolved solids or FDS threshold, which is an annual average flow weighted fixed dissolved salts concentration of the source water, so the water used to make the wine, plus 320 milligrams per liter. We use this threshold because it is the dissolved solids that are not biodegradable and can accumulate in the soil and do have the biggest impact to groundwater potentially. And a threshold means it's not a violation to exceed the value, but it is a violation to not do the required actions when an exceedance occurs. So some of those follow-up actions are for tier 2 through 3, the regional board can require a salt control plan. And then for tier 4, if there's an exceedance of the threshold, a salt control plan is required. I wanted to note that the discharger may elect, instead of doing a site-specific salt control plan, to participate in a salt and nutrient management plan or sustainability program addressing winery salt loading instead of implementing a site-specific salt control plan when required. Next slide, please. Moving on to monitoring. So there is a lot of monitoring in the order. We're going to go over it briefly today. So it does include what's called a model monitoring and reporting program. And it's a model because it's a general statewide order. And the final monitoring requirements are issued with the notice of applicability by the regional board. However, the reporting requirements as part of the monitoring program are generally as follows. There's an annual report due March 1st of the reporting year. And then if you're doing groundwater, there's a semi-annual report that's due March 1st or August 1st. And this is primarily for tier 4 wineries. And in some cases, the smaller wineries and the other tiers that are doing that alternate nitrogen subsurface disposal system groundwater monitoring instead of meeting the effluent limit. In general, the annual report is planned to be an electronic template report for each tier and includes the submittal of water quality results in GeoTracker. The purpose of the reporting is to verify compliance with the order requirements and identify potential facility or water quality issues ahead of impacts to groundwater. The order also requires all wineries to submit compliance letters monthly in instances of a violation or non-compliance occurring. The monitoring requirements provide monitoring flexibility to account for a variety of different winery operations, where the compliance points are tiered based on the size of the winery. The monitoring locations are dependent on the winery feature as well. For example, there's pond monitoring requirements, but if the winery isn't using a treatment pond, they wouldn't be required to do that monitoring. Next slide, please. Moving on to some of the the ways that the order supports sustainability. It does allow the use of Water Board accepted sustainability programs and salt nutrient management plan participation instead of some of the site-specific reports for compliance. And as mentioned earlier, there is an offered reduced fee for participation in the sustainability program. One of these programs that's coming up first is the California State Wine Growing Alliance, or Statewide California State Wine Growing Alliance, or CSWA. And we're working with this group later this year to see what the program contains and what the acceptance and evaluation process by the State Water Board would be for this program. We also believe that communities, including disadvantaged communities, will be supported by the beneficial use protections of the order, such as protections for industrial drinking water supply from salt nitrogen impacts. The order supports efficient water use goals through the beneficial reuse of processed water for possible aquifer recharge by allowing crop irrigation using winery processed water, and by ensuring pond sizing is for large storm events regardless of seasonality, as we know that the peak sizes are changing. The order encourages on-farm composting and the reuse of winery processed solid materials, the reuse of winery processed solid materials on site to support the Governor's Healthy Soil Initiative, because this sequesters carbon as part of addressing climate change efforts. Wineries also have an incentive to reduce the volume of supply water they use to produce wine, because if they're on the cusp between tier 3 and 4, if they might be able to reduce the amount of processed water they produce and actually get into a lower regulatory tier. Next slide. Thank you. State Board staff are working on the phased development of electronic notice of intent and statewide notifications for wineries to enroll. We're also developing additional guidance and templates to assist the regulated community with implementation. We will continue to work closely with the regions and interested parties on the development of these materials. Thank you so much for your time. I'll now pass the presentation back to Melissa.
Great. Thank you, Laurel, for your overview of the order. You can go to the next slide, Guy. Thanks. So this table includes our estimate of the number of wineries in our region per county, but just note that these are only estimates and the number of wineries that will need to enroll may differ depending on size. And this order for winery processed water discharges is separate from our region's vineyard program that regulates sediment discharges from vineyard properties in the Napa River and Sonoma Creek watersheds, although some of the same wineries will be included under both permits. So I just want to take a moment today to say that we invited Napa County staff here because the county will be a key partner implementing the order for the wineries located in Napa County. And they'll be working under the order's provisions for an accepted local agency oversight program to manage implementation. And we've worked with the State Board for years on the order and consulted our stakeholders to include a local agency oversight program for counties. We're currently coordinating with Napa County on the role with the local agency oversight program and are developing a regional implementation plan. So right now I'll turn it over to Kim Withrow to share more about Napa County's winery program. Next slide.
Thanks, Melissa. So I'm the supervisor of the County Environmental Health, Well and On-Site Wastewater Treatment Subdivision within Planning, Building and Environmental Services. And my team's responsible for regulating wastewater treatment and disposal systems in the unincorporated area of Napa County and any parcels that aren't served by public sewer located within the city limits. We annually permit and inspect alternative sewage treatment systems, liquid waste haulers, winery wastewater ponds, and holding tanks. And we respond to complaints regarding illicit discharges, odors, and illegal and substandard construction of wastewater systems. We permit winery processed water discharges to land via subsurface disposal systems, as well as those with processed water ponds by authority granted by the Regional Water Board some time ago. In fact, in 1979, the Regional Water Board issued a letter authorizing Napa County to permit subsurface disposal from small wineries. And we've been doing that since that time. A memorandum of understanding between Napa County and the Regional Water Board was established in 1982 and then updated again in 1985. And that is our basis of our winery wastewater pond program. In September of 2003, the regional board provided authorization for us to permit advanced treatment of winery waste with the storage of the treated processed water and then land surface discharge. So we work closely with our winery partners and the permitted facilities on this program and have for many years. Next slide, please. So our program components are begins with the design standards and technical guidelines to permit reviews, including the use permit review as new projects are evaluated under the California Environmental Quality Act. We do routine and complaint inspections and ongoing monitoring and reporting. Inspections are completed at the construction stage, and then ongoing inspections are conducted annually for all pond systems and at least biannually for systems with advanced treatment beyond the standard septic tank to leach field. These are referred to as our alternative systems. The alternative systems are required to be monitored by an approved service provider. And most ponds are monitored by a third-party company that specializes in wastewater treatment and sampling. Some ponds are monitored and maintained by our winery personnel. Pond facilities are required to report quarterly their total wastewater flow, their BOD during the months that they process water is being discharged, their activities occurring in the winery, their gallons of wine produced, and the freeboard, and if their pH or DO were at proper levels during that reporting period. Next slide. So there are approximately 484 wineries, of which 382 are currently producing and 60 are pending and are approved but are not yet producing. The approximate number of total wineries may include some within sewer districts or cities that would either be connected to public sewer or utilize Holden Hall or have a WDR issued by the regional board. So these numbers might not completely add up because you consider those. Approximately 212 are in our county's existing regulatory program, including a Holden Hall program. Of the total wineries, 58 facilities have processed water ponds, 29 wineries have advanced treatment and discharge to the land surface, and 265 wineries have subsurface discharge. Of these, we have about 90 that are permitted with advanced treatment before subsurface discharge. The total wineries anticipated under the general order are estimated to be between 400 and 450. About 200 facilities are currently without regulatory oversight, and they will include facilities that fall below the exemption or produce less than the 10,000 gallons per year. Next slide. So we've been collaborating with the water boards throughout the development of the winery order, and now we continue to work with the regional water board in determining how to best implement the order in Napa County. We're considering changes to our existing program consistent with the winery general order and are considering the scope of a potential local agency oversight program that will work with our stakeholders and that the county can manage. We're soliciting input from our stakeholders on the approach and will obtain approval from Napa County Board of Supervisors before applying to become the local agency. Next slide. So we have appreciated collaborating with regional board staff to develop a regional implementation plan. The implementation plan will ensure consistency throughout the region. It will help establish phasing by tier or type of system and establishes the foundation and scope of our local program and will set expectations for both the county and the regional board. Next slide. So we have quite a few things to do before we could actually apply to be the local agency. And so a few of these are listed here. Napa County Code will have to be updated, which would include a hearing before our Board of Supervisors. We have to update our technical standards to bring them in line with the general order. Our staffing levels will have to be evaluated after further development of the implementation plan. We'll have to see if our 8 staff that we currently have will be enough to do this work. The fees will have to be evaluated, and either new fees or increased fees will have to be brought back to the board for a public hearing and approval. So we still have quite a few things to do, and we look forward to continuing our relationship with regional board staff as this progresses. I'll send this back to Melissa. Thanks. Next slide.
Thank you so much, Kim, for presenting with us today and also for providing winery permitting efforts and for the county's collaborative approach. It means a lot. So as I mentioned, we're working closely with State Water Board staff on an overall order implementation plan, in addition to collaborating with Napa County on our regional implementation plan. So the boxes on this slide highlight key aspects of our regional implementation efforts. So our implementation plan is currently being drafted and will address aspects such as permitting workflows, local agency oversight program roles and responsibilities, and of regular, sorry about that. I had a little glitch on my computer here, sorry. And we'll also address our outreach efforts. So to support the order's implementation, we're also building staff capacity in our section and tapping into cross-divisional support through our internal sustainable groundwater work group, our vineyard program, and our stormwater team. We are gleaning lessons learned and helpful insights from our successful implementation of the vineyard order. And as mentioned, we are also regularly participating in meetings with Napa County and State Board staff to coordinate on the implementation process. And since we share regulatory jurisdiction in Sonoma County with the North Coast Regional Water Board, we are collaborating to align our approaches as well. And to support the regulated community's understanding and compliance with the order, we're also drafting technical guidance and monitoring program templates for each tier. And as you may recall, we were drafting a regional winery order prior to teaming with the State Board on the statewide order, also as Mike had mentioned. And through that effort, we engaged with representatives from the wine industry, and we are continuing to build upon and strengthen that collaborative relationship. We have also teamed with State Board on various outreach efforts and will continue to develop our regional outreach and engagement with the counties and wineries in our region. Next slide. And finally, with a large number of wineries and limited staff resources, we are prioritizing enrollment to ensure the process can run smoothly. So this slide summarizes the prioritization factors. So in the first phase of enrollment, we will consider a facility's current permitting status and aim to enroll those wineries that lack regulatory coverage for their winery process water discharges. The State Board is currently developing an electronic notice of intent process to support the enrollment and to meet the order required 3-year enrollment timeline for unpermitted wineries. And of course, we will consider the potential threat to water quality. Thus, that will lead to prioritizing larger wineries and those discharging to land overlying a groundwater basin with pre-existing elevated concentrations of nitrate. Next slide. Thank you again. This concludes our presentation. And listed here is contact information, where to sign up for the State Board's email list, and the winery order webpage. So we're happy to answer any questions and discuss this further. Thanks.
Thank you so much for the comprehensive, mind-bogglingly comprehensive presentation, all of you. And so I'll return it to the board to see if there's any questions or comments.
Jim?
Andy. Go ahead, Andy.
Thank you. That was a very comprehensive presentation. And I just have a couple of questions here. If I understood things correctly about, I know we're not sure exactly how many wineries are going to qualify, but it sounds like about half of the wineries in California that will qualify for this permit are in our region. Does that sound right, Melissa? Is that ballpark?
Land, if we're ballparking it, yeah, I would say about so. Maybe a little more, but definitely a heavy lean in our region for sure.
Okay. And so in that kind of situation, then, do we have there? I would imagine that there are this program has a little more importance to us than to other regions. And I'm assuming that we have a really strong collaborative relationship with the state that's helping move this forward, and really, because we have a lot of existing knowledge, including, as you mentioned, we were already moving ahead in our own program. So is that being reflected as the process is ongoing?
Interesting question. I know one piece that also kind of makes it a little bit of a heavier lift, I think, in this region in particular, is some other regions that had wineries had some pre-existing regional winery orders themselves. So that kind of, which, you know, that was not the case here. So I think that there's definitely, hence why while we were talking about expanding our own staff capacities, as well as making sure to collaborate with the regional boards and state board staff has been very helpful to offer implementation assistance throughout this project, knowing that there is a bit more of a lift in our region. I mean, luckily we have Napa County, of course, that has been providing a lot of that assistance too.
Right. So I was also interested that the way you're thinking about prioritizing, you know, particularly, you know, if somebody is discharging and there is a groundwater basin with a nitrate problem. Okay. So, but I guess in general, I'm trying to get a handle on, are we doing this because there's an existing problem, an existing loss of beneficial uses, or are we doing this because it's clear that if we don't do it, there will be?
Oh, okay. Well, we are hoping to get at it before there's a major issue, to be honest. Okay.
That's brilliant. That's exactly the way I would like to know that we're thinking this through and realizing this is something that needs to happen. And then lastly, there's no one here from the wine industry. I'm interested in, it is my impression that we have a very thoughtful and collaborative relationship with this industry that works regularly, thinks ahead. I know in terms of climate change that the Wine Institute's been doing a lot of work. And I just wondered whether our collaborative relationship is, in the past, is allowing us to do this project very effectively, and that we're getting a lot we're able to work through questions and disagreements and have the industry itself be working, you know, be part of our effort to try and prevent a problem from developing.
Yeah. Okay. I know real quick though, the first answer that I said, yes, we don't have a problem, was really short answer. There's so many more, I think, factors that are going into the purpose of this order. I didn't want to just say there's nothing wrong at all, but just a caveat, it's complex. But I also think, okay, so in reference to involving the wine industry. So as I mentioned before, we were involved for years with planning or developing a regional order. And through that time, definitely built a meaningful stakeholder group with representatives of the wine industry, and also had during that time had like focus group meetings too, to glean information from those that are on the ground really implementing and running these wineries, so that their feedback was continuously feeding through our development and then bringing that insight to the state board's effort. And Laurel, I know I see that Mike and Laurel's hands are up, and Laurel's done a tremendous job also of continuing the outreach. We've worked a lot with wine industry the Wine Institute, excuse me. And so we're hoping, I mean, obviously any kind of regulatory oversight is somewhat challenging or could be frustrating to an entity or an industry. And I believe that we are trying to navigate this, or not trying, that we are navigating this conscientiously and through the lens of a true stakeholder. And so I don't know if Laurel wants to add more to that, because I know for me personally, it's extremely valuable to have the voices of those involved directly and trying to really truly build a working partnership, because the breadth of this in the state of California is much, it requires solution thinking from all parties involved. So anyways, I'll let Laurel say something about that if you would like.
I just wanted to echo what Melissa is sharing and just say that the order adoption was challenging. It set a new process statewide. It's hard to put 1,500 or so wineries into one general order. And, you know, moving forward, the Wine Institute and like partners have been a huge help in helping steer what needs to be completed first for implementation, and we meet with them regularly. And we're very open at State Board to be meeting with stakeholders and hearing concerns and ideas on how to make this efficient. I see Scott put his mic on in his hand. So I just wanted to thank also the regions for all their support and participation, because we wouldn't be here today without their expertise as well.
Scott, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Scott Couch from the Division of Water Quality at State Board. And I just wanted to chime in that from my perspective, our relationship with the Wine Institute and the industry has gotten stronger during this process. It's been several years. They've had some turnover in their leadership. We've had some turnover in our leadership, but I think our relationship has gotten better over time, and we have been able to work out. We obviously did not agree on many, many things as we went through this. And so we've been able to come to an agreement on several occasions. Many, many issues that things were negotiated with the board and over at the Capitol and everywhere else. But I think our relationship has gotten better, and they have me on their speed dial. So,
okay, thank you very much. Yeah, that's what I was hoping to hear.
Michael, did you have something to add there?
Yeah, I was just in the response to the earlier, and I think Melissa, you know, was kind of getting there as we do have some nitrate impacts in some of our ag basins. Fortunately, not the kind of problems that they have in the Central Valley with nitrates and salts. It's not, you know, had a hugely significant impact on drinking water supplies, but there's enough of an indication of the potential for there to be impacts that this becomes a really important effort. And I really want to thank, Melissa for her collaboration with our groundwater team, you know, that's working on these salt nutrient management plans with the counties and working on, you know, getting the gamma data and looking at these basins over longer time frames and seeing what trends or patterns we're seeing with some of these the pollutants associated with this wastewater in our groundwater. Because, you know, I think as the board understands completely, when we're in times of drought, we get heavier reliance on groundwater. So we're pumping more groundwater, we're using more groundwater. And it's an important source of water, even though in our region we're not as dependent on it as, say, other regions. But that's even more important that we protect it. So I'll stop there.
Other board questions? Alexis.
I thank each of you for the presentations. Two very brief comments. One, as you go forward with devising the template for the annual report, I was going to encourage us to be modest in what we ask for and focus on how we use that information going forward rather than in having a very comprehensive annual report. I think after all these decades in a regulatory world, I know we have good intentions, but we don't always use the data that we ask dischargers to give to us. So let's think about that template in a way of what really will we use going forward. And then I wanted to offer from my prior experience that on the Clean Air Act side, large wineries have very complex regulatory challenges in terms of what is stored and what the emissions from those storage vessels can be. And I think that it's more contentious and more difficult. Some of the smaller wineries have very good technological approaches to this, but I think that we are in a nice place here with our Porter Cologne approach and with the partnership with Napa County. Thank you, Kim. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, we do have one public comment.
Can you unmute them and tell me who they are?
Yes, it's Kelly, and Kelly, you should be able to unmute yourself.
Kelly, go ahead.
Thank you. The impact of the wine industry is far broader, and this presentation is very good, though, as far as the slice of the industry's impacts that is being addressed here. It starts with the water supply. For example, the area that I'm familiar with, which is called the Livermore Valley, wine production is the vineyards are consuming 12 to 15% of the entire water supply for a heavily urbanized region. And they don't extract water from the groundwater at all because that water has too much boron in it. So they get all their water from a much higher quality supply called the South Bay Aqueduct, which is the Delta, which is would be better water for people to drink. But that's another story. Then when it comes to land use regulations and zonings and laws are being designed and custom fit to this industry. The zoning laws are all tailored to fit whatever they need. On discharges, they're talking about building extra sewer lines to outside the urban boundaries of the large cities to service these industries, which would be a good thing, actually, rather than having a lot of septic systems everywhere. And finally, this entire regulatory framework is based on the assumption that these counties are competent and well-meaning and not completely dedicated to other interests other than the public good. And you've brought in Napa County, and I have no reason to believe that any of that is a false assumption in Napa County. But elsewhere, outside of Napa County, all of those assumptions need to be carefully scrutinized, because there are many aspects of county government that need to be that cannot be taken for granted. Thank you.
Thank you, Kelly. Laurel, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I wanted to thank the member of the public, Kelly, who just spoke. I wanted to add a little clarification that this is a statewide order primarily implemented by the water board, so the regional boards as well as state board. And then the counties are, of course, partners, but we would carefully vet any local agency oversight program. That's not the de facto order implementation, that's an application. I just wanted to make that clarification if it wasn't in there.
Thank you, Laurel. Wonderful presentation, wonderful cooperation. I know it wasn't always so, and it's nice to get to the end. There's a couple things I'd like to comment. First of all, and I'm going to reach back to Dr. Young, my predecessor and mentor and dear friend, to talk about, this was one of the glass balls that she said, Jim, you cannot let drop. And her work in setting up the necessary negotiations and the outreach to stakeholders was key to this. So it should not be ignored. But even more deeply than that, Terry said at some point that when you touch the agricultural community, you should touch them as lightly and as close to where they live as you possibly can. So that's in fact the case here. She was always insistent that there be a local option here, and it was the county of Napa and their direct involvement and their credibility that was that. Now they're not alone, and I know there are problems in some areas, but that ethos. The other thing I would like to give her credit for is the culture that I see in our staff, which is to talk to the the end users, to talk to the dischargers, to listen to them very, very carefully. And it's embodied in what we see here. Those are about as high a kudos as we can see for something that had a few rough moments. It's arrived at a very good place, and I really appreciate the team. And none of you, it could not have been done without any of you. So thank you, Kim. Thank you, Laurel. And thank you, Lisa.
Thank you.
Michael, do we have anything else? I know that you had noticed a potential executive session, a closed session. Are we going to go forward with one? Thank you.
No, we do not have a closed session. I did want to share some correspondence that was received. We've gotten some postcards that were sent to the chair regarding the Newark Area 4 housing development. The board will recall back in February, we did an item in the executive officer's report on this proposed development down in Newark. And we had a number of members from NGOs and the public that provided comment during the public forum. And I just wanted to share, we'll share these with the board members. And if there are folks that want to get copies of this, you can email us here and we'll provide a copy. We can't post these online because of the difficulty in having to meet ADA requirements, but we can make them available upon request. But I did want to share that we've continued to get these kind of commentary on opposition to that project from folks, members of the public. I don't have anything else.
Can I ask a quick question about that?
Sure.
Are we in pre-filing conversations about that property at all?
Or? No, we've not received an application. Okay. We had sent a letter along with BCDC on some of the CEQA work that had been done. It's not pending at this point, but we're aware of it. And I don't know if Keith Licton, did you want to add anything on the status of that?
No, Mike, I think you've summarized it correctly.
Okay, thanks.
And Mike, a quick preview of the next board meeting, which is going to be one of the heavy ones.
We are going to have our work cut out for us, yes. Keith and Tom and the rest of the team have been working really hard to get the municipal regional permit ready to go out. And we expect it to go out on Friday. And that will allow us to meet our target for having our next board meeting, which will be a two-day meeting. We will have a little bit of routine board business on the morning of the first day, which will be on the 12th, Tuesday the 12th. But we'll spend the bulk of the remainder of the 12th and possibly most of the 13th going through the permit and taking comment. And the team has come up with a very thoughtful approach towards presenting that, which we'll be able to share with you all in advance of that. I don't know if there's any other preview that Tom or Keith want to provide, but there'll be a lot of reading to be done. So make sure you have some time to review that package.
Oh, this is Tom. I'll just add that, yeah, what we are proposing to do, and we're working with the permittees, municipalities, and then other interested parties on a structured hearing where we would rather than present everything all at once and then have open comment on all aspects of the permit, we're proposing to present the key permit elements in blocks or modules and then have testimony focusing in on those issues. And we'll work with particularly the municipalities to and I'm pretty confident they're willing to do this, to for them to organize their comments in a block of time, so it's just not won't to avoid just a long series of commenters on the same thing. So they recognize the benefit of being efficient about how they present their points for your attention. So hopefully it'll still adds up to a considerable amount of hearing time, but we are striving to manage it as best as possible.
Thank you. I like that. Just for meeting mechanics, it's going to be a long enough meeting that we're going to have to take multiple breaks. Either you can make the chat operation work so somebody can tell me if they're getting desperate, or you can just raise your hands and blurt out. I don't want anybody to be uncomfortable. We have to think through some tough stuff here. So just make sure that I have a way to understand that people need a break.
All right, we'll come up with a code word.
With that, I'm ready for a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
In a second. I'll second.
I'll second.
All right, all in favor?
Have a good day, everybody.
All right, thank you all.
All right, see you soon. Bye, y'all.